This is episode 20 of season 4 of The Bad Apples. Hi everyone, my name is Klaatu, and this is my Linux and geeky and technological and Unix-like Ogcast. For this episode, for whatever reason, I say every 20 episodes is a new season, so this is the 20th episode of the 4th season, meaning that the next episode is the first episode of the 5th season. That doesn't really mean that anything changes. It's pretty much been the same format for the entire time I've done the show, but it just kind of helps me keep track of where I am and what I'm doing and stuff like that. So, this is the final episode, and for that reason, I'm just going to go on and on for as long as I need to go on for. So, rather than trying to keep the episode in the typical 40 to 45 to 50 minute range, I'll just be going, you know, a little bit longer maybe, just depending on what I want to say about each topic. The topics I'm going to be talking about this episode will include Mer, the alternate operating system for the Nokia N8X0 series, so the N800 or the N810. I'm going to be talking about a special, exciting end-of-the-season contest I will be holding. Just some ponderances on PCBSD, OpenSolaris, other Unixes, Tiny Core Linux. I'll mention World of Goo, the game that came out recently, or the game that is on Linux, and it was sold for a cheap price lately, so I saw a copy on Linux and stuff like that, so I'll be talking about that. And I will finally take some listener feedback, and that'll take perhaps a little while. But like I say, this is an extra long, which won't probably be all that long, but it'll be a longer than usual episode, big season finale, very exciting stuff. Stay tuned. So the Ontario Linux Fest happened a little while ago now, a couple of weeks now. And I was not only scheduled to go to the Ontario Linux Fest, but I was actually also scheduled to speak at the Ontario Linux Fest. I was going to do my Blender talk that I did at Ohio Linux Fest, because some people wanted to hear it again, thought it would be good for their festival, which was flattering, and I was excited to go. I haven't been to Canada in a long time, so I was really excited. And I had everything set up. I had a ride share and a room share and everything. And then someone mentioned, kind of just off the cuff, too bad you need a passport to get into Canada now, or something like that. And I thought, well, that's weird, that's wrong, you don't need a passport for Canada, that's ridiculous. Well, turns out they were right. You can get into Canada with the passport, but you can't, I guess, get back out without a passport. At least not into the United States of America. So, apparently, you know, I mean, I'm not going to get political here, but let's just suffice it to say that America requires a passport to get into the country from apparently any other place, you know, even Canada, which borders, you know, I mean, we as quote-unquote countries, we seem to, you know, we have this imaginary line that we drew from one end of the continent to the other end. I don't see what the point of trying to enforce any kind of border there is, simply because it is such a huge border. But yeah, they've got their concerns, I guess, their reasonings, whatever. So that's the long and short of it. So too bad I couldn't go, because I didn't have my passport. Of course, I had one at one point, but it expired, and I just never renewed it because I don't know, I didn't really intend on going anywhere anytime soon, but I always thought that Canada was one option that I had open to me, but apparently not. So, too bad. Missed the Ontario Linux Fest. I was not happy about it. I got really pretty grumpy about it for a couple of days, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but that's enough of skirting apolitical issues. So, there you go. I wasn't at Ontario. I didn't get to talk. I didn't get to experience their festival. Not cool. I was very upset. But, oh well. It's, you know, it happens. Next year, I will make plans to attend, and I will, you know, make sure that I've got all the paperwork and bureaucratic requirements met well before going up there. As far as I know, I don't need a passport to get down to Florida, but, by the time I figured out that I wasn't going to Ontario, And Florida was the same weekend, so I mean, technically speaking, I could have just gone down to Florida, but I just didn't have rides in place and things like that, so it wasn't going to happen. And that's a lot farther from where I am right now, you know, all the way down to Florida. That's a pretty major drive, so that didn't happen. Hopefully next year. So aside from that, let's talk about the Nokia. So the Nokia N800. You know, I've raved about this ever since I got it, and if you don't know the whole story, the rough whole story is that I was given an iPhone by someone as a gift, and I had it for, I don't know, 3 months maybe, and you know, when they, no, I had it as long as it took them to finally, you know, crack the code or whatever, you know, like jailbreak it, I guess. And that happened pretty quickly, I think. This was like the original iPhone. So I had it, and, you know, I played around with it a little bit, and it was interesting. I think at the time I was still half on OS X, half on Linux, so accessing it wasn't that difficult because I had an OS X box that I could interface with the iPhone through. It was interesting. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it yet. And the more I started hearing about other platforms like Nokia N800 and stuff, which I think was coming out around the same time, I really started just realizing that I couldn't do that much with my iPhone, and understand that this, I mean, the original one didn't even have extra apps yet. I mean, it was just literally, I mean, it was a horrible platform. And I was, you know, getting, I mean, finally I did jailbreak mine, I guess. Yeah, I did. I jailbroke it. I never updated, I think, or something like that. Anyway, I didn't do something that made it very, very desirable after Apple started bricking people's iPhones. So after that started happening, people still wanted an iPhone that could be jailbroken so that they could use it, I guess, for different services or something. I'm not really sure. I wasn't really using it as a phone, so I didn't really know what was going on with that. But yeah, someone, you know, it was very desirable. So I posted on Craigslist or something that I would trade someone their Nokia N800 for my iPhone. Needless to say, I mean, like, the perceived value of an iPhone was still just ridiculously high. You know, people just, they thought it was like gold, so I didn't have any trouble making that trade. So a guy brought me his N800 with, you know, complete, in new in the box, practically new in the box. I mean, it had been a little bit used, but I mean, he still had all the box, the packaging, the everything that came with it. So we traded. So that was a really, really good trade, actually. It really worked out. So I've had it for ever since then, and I've loved it, and I use it all the time. I use it for everything. You know, I mean, as different jobs that I take on change, you know, I might use it more or less between a given few months or whatever, but basically, I mean, it's been practically my primary email and IM machine for a while. It's always been my primary pod catching and one of my primary pod listening devices. It's something that I use all the time. So, and I'm usually not very far from a Wi-Fi signal. Like, all my jobs that I do take typically are near a Wi-Fi signal, so that I can use. So, you know, I don't need the whole cell data plan or whatever. So it's a perfect device for me. Now, all the raving aside, the OS on it, the MIMO OS, or MIMO, that is on it, is nice. It's great. I love it. I can't complain about it, except, of course, you must have seen that coming. I can, a little bit. So one of the problems with MIMO or MIMO or whatever is that it's very much, again, I guess it's just that kiosk feel, you know, where you've got flexibility, but only as far as they want to give it to you, you know? I mean, it's like you've got everything you need, and you've got lots of apps that you can add, and you've got repositories that you can add, and you got cool little features, and you've even got a terminal, so you can do some stuff in the terminal. And, you know, it's all very cool and very fun and very empowering. But at the same time, there are things about it that just, I just can't, you know, I just they annoy me sometimes. Like, you know, the fact that I can't actually establish a username on this thing and make it like a normal sort of multi-user Linux system. The fact that I need to kind of do weird hacks to get root access to my own device. Random things like that. One of the big things, the fact that when you install an application from a repository, it's going into the designated application folder. I don't know if it's /user/bin/user/localbin or where it is, but that all the applications are going there. And you don't really have a choice to say, okay, well, reassign this application location to, for instance, my internal SD card or even my removable SD card. You know, so I mean, I could buy 64 gigabyte little SD cards or whatever, you know, whatever the biggest size they are. Let's say 64. Two of those, you know, 128 gigabytes in my Nokia I could have. And even so, I would only have 250 megabyte on the internal device memory, as they call it. Now, I'm sure there's probably some elaborate hack around that. Like, I could log in as root, I could symlink whatever location the applications are actually being installed into to the internal SD card, stuff like that. And I might try that soon, and just to see what happens. But at the same time, you know, and that's fun, and that's cool. So again, I can't really complain about MAMO at all. I really like it. Diablo is a fantastic little release. I like it a lot. But two factors kind of got me curious about alternatives. Three factors. One is my natural curiosity about alternatives. Two is the fact that Nokia is going to stop sort of developing MAMO. So it's kind of, you know, the N800 relevancy days are kind of numbered. At some point, they're going to just stop making new stuff for the Nokia N800. And I'm going to have to, you know, people are going to have to kind of pick up that slack. And you don't really know, you know, we don't really know what that's going to turn into. And then number three, of course, is the application limitation. That I don't really have flexibility over the system as easily as I would like. Again, there might be some hacks around it. I'm going to play around with that. But there is a big hack around all of this, and it's called MER, or MER. So MER is a French word meaning ocean or sea, actually. You have probably heard of this term, or a derivative of the term, or rather, vice versa. Mare tranquillis, for instance, on the moon, Latin for sea of tranquility, right? So mare is ocean or sea, body of water. French being a romantic, a romance language based on Latin, it is the word meaning sea or ocean in French. So MER, it is a port of Ubuntu 9.04 for the ARM processor over to the N800. I don't know if port is the correct term. It might be. Maybe it's just a version of. But yes, that is what it is. It is Ubuntu for the ARM processor, tweaked and themed and changed for the Nokia N800 and 810, and I guess technically the 770, although there seem to be some weird caveats here and there, kind of like, you know, you gotta be careful, the Wi-Fi connection might crash on the 770 for this reason or that reason, or whatever. So, I don't know, but definitely for the 800. So, installing it is, I'm not going to say easy, I'm not going to say hard. It's not the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. It's not the easiest one-click kind of like, install MAMO, here it goes, and you're done. Or rather, install MER, or MER, and here you go. It's a little bit complex. You have to do some thinking and some preparation. So the first stage, okay, first of all, you can go to the site at wiki.mamo.org, that is wiki.mamo.org/MER, with a capital M, and that is just M-E-R. So that is their homepage. You can read all about the project. And I did an interview with one of the guys on the MER project at Southeast Linux Fest. He was one of the guys doing the themes for MER. It was really informative. That's the first I'd heard of this project, and I was really excited about it. Still am, frankly. So anyway, you go to the wiki.mamo.org/MER, and it is it's nice. It's a really nice site. Looks nice, and it is actually quite indicative of what you're about to see on your Nokia. I mean, it's a really well-designed, really smart-looking little OS. So, to actually implement this, you first need to... Well, let's talk about preparation first. You first need to make sure that your Nokia has at the very least, five megabytes of available device memory. So this is not memory on your SD card. This is the device memory in your actual, I think it's the flashing directory is the name of the directory. If you do not have at least, and again, this is at the very least, 5 megabytes of available memory, then you're not going to want to attempt to do this yet, because you're going to be flashing the device, reflashing some chips on the device itself. You need to really make sure that you've got enough room for this to occur, because if it doesn't, It could, I guess, worst case scenario, it can, you know, kind of make your Nokia not bootable and you'll have to reflash it. And that's not the hardest thing to do in the world either, but you may or may not want to do that. Which brings us to our next step of preparation, which is, of course, backing up all your data. So if you've got stuff on your Nokia that is important to you that you need to preserve, or just maybe just convenient stuff that you don't want to screw up, you don't want to lose, then you're going to want to back this up. And there is an application in MAMO for just an instant device memory backup little tool, and it kind of grabs all the stuff on the device memory and wraps it up and backs it up for you. And that way you preserve all your user accounts and stuff like that. So in terms of, again, freeing up the device memory, you might have to uninstall some of the applications. And in my case, I use it so much, and I like to play around with the OS and see what is available out there. So I installed a lot of applications, and many of them, I would uninstall after a while, but some of them I just leave on there just on the off chance that I wanted to use it sometime. But when it came around to the time of needing to install this new OS, to be safe, I ditched a lot of spare applications that, I wasn't going to use. One of these was Fennec, the Mozilla mobile browser. Fennec doesn't take up that much room, but Zool Runner is like 32 megabytes, and you're like, 32 megs, that's not that much. Well, keep in mind that the device memory available is only like 250 megabytes, so that's like one-eighth or one-twelfth of your device memory or something. It's a lot, so yeah, uninstall something very large so that you can reclaim some space on your device before doing this. The other preparatory step that you should have, you should make sure you've got taken care of, is that you're online, because this is going to require you to download some stuff. Make sure you're there. And also make sure that you're plugged in. There is no reason to ever do a big OS event like this, like reflashing your device or installing a new OS on your SD card, whatever, with, on battery power. That's just not smart. So be plugged in, have power, make sure that your device is not going to turn off in the middle of all this, because that could really be bad. That could, in theory, that could fry a chip and just, it could be over for you. So please make sure that you're powered, you're secure, you're not going to be interrupting anything while you're reflashing your device. So with all those steps taken care of, now all we need to do is on your actual device, on the N800 or N810, or 770, from what I hear. Go to the wiki site, wiki.mamo.org/mer, and navigate to the download page, and there's a link for the .install file or something like that. And it's actually a link to a repository. So you click on that, and it offers to add this repository to your application manager. So you accept that, and then automatically it will start to install different little applications, and I don't remember the names of them, but one is the chip flasher for the bootloader. One is a program called Install Mer, and there are a couple of other things on there too. You can just say okay to all that stuff. Let it install everything that it wants to install, and you can verify what it is asking you to install versus what it claims that it needs to install on the website to make sure that you're actually installing the right stuff. But it went really smoothly for me. I think I want to say that at some point along here there was like an unnaturally long pause where after it installed the repository, it then it looked like it was finished doing everything that it was going to do, but you just have to wait because actually it's working, it's processing something. It could have been here, could have been a little bit later in this process, but I do remember a very strangely, unnaturally long pause, but it's all okay, it's actually working, it just takes a little bit longer than you might be used to. So basically all this has done is it's installed two applications on your device, in your application menu, and if you now go to your application menu on the Nokia, over to Utilities, you will now find two new apps that you've downloaded. One is called Install Bootloader, and one is called Install Mer. So, the first thing to do is to install the OS. From the Applications menu, from the Utilities submenu, you can select Install Mer. Now, for this, you want to have an SD card either in your internal slot or your external slot. Doesn't really matter, but you want to have one of those in there and ready to accept Mer. In my experience, 2 gigabyte is plenty of room. I tried a 4 gigabyte I guess it's technically a micro SD card. It's like, it's this absurdly little, tiny, small SD card that you then put into a slightly larger adapter and plug it into your device. I've never been able to get this thing to act as a boot device. I've tried it in my Triple E, I've tried it in the Nokia. It just doesn't seem to want to work. 2 gigs, I think, will be plenty for me, and I can use a 4 gig card if I really need to as extra storage or whatever. So I grabbed the 2 gig card, popped it into the internal slot, and designated, you know, in my mind that that was going to be the place. So then you click install, meh, and it launches a terminal and kind of steps you through the process. And this has some pop-up, it's probably like Zenity or something similar, you know, pop-up menus that say, or dialog boxes rather, that give you options. I did a simple install because I didn't want to bother trying to partition the SD card myself, but you can do an advanced and actually use CF disk and you know, partition the thing the way you want it to be partitioned and stuff like that. So that's pretty neat. And I guess in that sense, I could probably have utilized the 4 gig card as part of my file system, just put the boot part on the SD card and then put the user stuff and the /local stuff on the 4 gig micro SD card. I probably could have done that, but I mean, this is two gigs is going to be plenty for me. So you do that, you step through it. Again, it asks you a couple of questions. Pretty much yes is the right answer for everything. Then it's going to update the boot menu so that it actually knows, you know, so that the bootloader knows, oh, there's a bootable partition over here on this SD card. So anyway, after it, it's going to take a while. I mean, it's 132 megabyte image for this little ARM port of Ubuntu that is meh. And then it's going to just kind of copy that, all those files over to your SD card after it partitions it, you know. So it takes a little while. Walk away, have a cup of coffee, whatever. Come back, and what do you know? It's all installed. So to install the bootloader, you simply click on Install Bootloader from the Applications menu, from the Utilities submenu, and it launches a terminal for you, and it's a root terminal, and it warns you about some things and asks you about some stuff. The website tells you what to say. I think it's yes to all questions, actually, with optional no's if you don't want certain features, but I think I said yes to everything. And then it warns you, okay, we're going to reflash the device now. Are you ready? And if you're ready, you say yes, and it reflashes your device. Now, interestingly, this does not erase any of your data. This is like reflashing, like the equivalent of the MBR. I don't know if that's what it's technically called in embedded devices and stuff like that, but whatever it's flashing, it's just the little space on the chip or the chip itself that has everything to do with the boot loading process. So that instead of just turning on your Nokia and seeing the nice white Nokia screen that leads you to the OS, you're going to see the option to click your menu key while press and hold your menu key while it's booting so that you can get taken into a little bootloader, like a little Lilo or something like that. So you do that. It takes a little bit, not too long, and then it'll finish, and then it'll ask you to reboot. So you just hit return on your virtual keyboard to reboot, and it reboots for you. And like I say, while you're rebooting, you're going to notice some new text on the screen kind of at the top, and it says press and hold the menu button to see an advanced bootloader or something like that. So the menu button is it's the one right above the house button on the N800. It's kind of that middle button with a little menu on it, predictably enough, I guess. I didn't know, so I was, like, clicking all the buttons. Well, not the house. I figured that wasn't the menu one. But it is kind of a weird thing. It doesn't seem to trigger the boot manager unless you do it at just the right moment or something, or you have to press and hold. I don't know. Just wait to see the option, and it doesn't last that long. It says, like, click and hold the menu button, and then in a few moments it's gone, you know, and I think the moment has passed. So you kind of have to watch it and then click the menu button and you hold it, and then you will be taken to a boot manager. So I don't know if it's technically Lilo or what, but it should list device memory or something like that, internal memory, I don't know, and then it'll say other partition on device P3 or something like that. I don't really remember what it says. I don't know really what it's getting its information from or anything, but it is there, and there's information on the website too on how to customize that menu and also make Mer your default the default OS that it will boot to, so that you don't have to keep hitting the menu key every time you start your device if you don't want to. So you do that. You use the little arrow key on the Nokia, you know, the little navigation button, go down and then hit the center button to press enter, and it starts to boot to Mer. And It's a beautiful, beautiful OS. It's stunningly beautiful, and it's really, really refreshing. The first thing you see is establish a user. It's beautiful. That's what I want to see on my Linux OS. You know, that is exactly what I want to see. During the installation, you enter a root password, by the way, but you only enter it once, so don't enter it wrong. You really need to be careful. Make sure that you're entering your root password, creating it correctly, because it will not ask you for it twice. It just asks you for it once and accepts it. So, but now that you've booted into Mech, it will ask you to install a user, or to create a user, rather. So, you know, type in Klaatu or whatever, type in, you know, you can name your device. You know, like a host name. You can establish a password for your user, all that other good stuff. So that's pretty neat. Then it boots into its little desktop, and it's a very, very sparse desktop, but already I'm liking it a lot more than the default MAMO desktop. Mainly because MAMO doesn't really have a desktop. It's got, you know, the menu bar at the top with some applets, and then it's got the menu bar down the side. And, I mean, I never really minded that, especially since you can go full screen so that both of those kind of go away anyway. But if you think about it, it's actually kind of, like, pretty bold to take up, I mean, what, even 50 pixels from the top and the side from a, what is it, 800 by 480 screen. I mean, you're already cutting your screen real estate down, you know, just for your main working environment. So what the Mech people have done is simply take a little bit off the top, and they seem to be concentrating on all, like, dialog boxes and notifications and that sort of thing occurring down at the bottom. So you've got this really smart setup where you've got information at the top and information at the bottom, and the middle always stays kind of in view. So it's really, really, really cleverly done. I'm very, very impressed by some of those decisions that they've made. Another cool thing is that on the top of the menu bar, on that little menu bar at the top, is not only a sort of a drop-down, you know, it looks like the MAMO selection menu. I mean, it's the same kind of deal with those little categories, internet communication, extra settings, stuff like that, and then sub-menus that branch off from that. That's fine. But there's that button, but then there's also a menu button. So whatever the active application is, rather than having like all the menus like file, edit, view, settings, window, help, you know, stuff like that along the top of the application, which obviously every application out there is going to have a similar set of menus, and it's just eating up screen real estate. Well, they take all those selections and dump them into this quote unquote menu, and it's really, really slick, because if it's the active application, you click on that little menu and you get that application's file or edit or view menu, you know, stuff like that. So it's really, really well done. That, of course, you'll see in OS X, and I've always liked that. I really have always liked that about OS X, or about the Apple set of OS's in general. It's just that the menu bar becomes contextual, you know, depending on the active application. It confuses a lot of people, but it's what I grew up with, and it just seems a lot more efficient to me, because you're not going to be accessing those menus, you know, unless that window is active. I mean, it's just not possible, in fact. So I really like that setup, and it saves screen real estate in this case, you know, which is really, really important. So it's really, really slick. Also at the top, you've got your wireless manager. You've got your power display, or power and display settings, like brightness and volume and stuff like that. I don't know if volume works yet. I don't have any application that will generate sound on there yet, but there's that. And I think something else. Oh, yeah, an application switcher is up there. So now if you want to switch between applications, you can just switch over to that. Funny thing, I mean, in a Fedora Reloaded episode, I talk about Moblin, and I kind of mentioned Moblin a little bit, I think, on Linux Cranks a couple of weeks ago or whatever, and I tried it out very briefly on my triple EPC, and while it is beautiful and it looks really slick and stuff like that, it feels clunky in design, whereas this Mech, it just looks so nice. But I'm not just talking about it looks nice, I'm talking about it is nice because it's designed well, you know, keeping the menu bar at the top It's fairly minimal in size and everything. You don't have a side menu bar. You don't have anything like that. You've got all the dialog boxes occurring at the bottom consistently so that you know where to look, and you also get, you know, it doesn't take over the middle of your screen, you know, it's just like at the bottom. And then you can still see stuff in the middle of your screen. So it's really, really, really smart. The application switcher being right up there at the top. I mean, Moblin, to do that, you have to go up to the top and go to your zones, and you get little thumbnails of all your applications. I mean, that's great, I guess, but I mean, it's just so much to switch an application. All I want to do is click somewhere and switch over to my application. So, and that's not unlike Memo either. I mean, they have that little application applet down the side, but in this one, it's all along the top, and it's just, it's really well designed. Application Manager is very similar in design to Memo, except that it also has, I guess, the ability, you can add like the Ubuntu ARM processor version repository and actually just install stuff from there if you want. Whether it's going to be optimized for the, you know, for this platform or not, I don't know. I haven't tried it yet, but you certainly can do that. Support for everything, I really don't know what it's like yet. I haven't played around with it quite as much as I've wanted to, so I can't tell you for sure that recording works or that playback works or that webcam works or anything like that. I do know that wireless works, and I do know that the SD card reader works and stuff like that. The default install has no file manager. The default install has like an Xterm and an application manager, and I think that's it. So you need to go to the repository pretty quickly and start, you know, installing stuff from the I guess the official MER repository. But it is really nice, and it does have a lot of cool things in it and on it and stuff. So very cool project, very, very neat project, something that you should definitely try out if you've got a Nokia N800. If you can risk the whole process of reflashing that little, you know, boot management portion of the chip, then I would definitely try this out. It's a really nice little OS. I've really enjoyed it, and I intend to continue to enjoy it. And the sooner I can switch to MER full time, the better, frankly. I'm really enjoying it, and it's just so Linuxy, you know. It's just like it's much more just an open kind of Linux system that you own, as opposed to the kind of kiosk specialized embedded device with a Linux backend. I mean, I respect that, and I love it, and it's great, but at the same time, what I really want is just another Linux box, just one that I can hold in my hand. So this is quite refreshing. It's quite a neat project, and in terms of extending the lifespan, I guess, of the N800, I think this could be one of the key things to that, because, I don't know the future of Memo, but I think they're moving on, I think, to the 900 series, and I don't know how much they're going to be doing with the 8X0 series or the 770. So MER could be a good thing for us in 8X0 and 770 users and owners and lovers. So yeah, check it out. It's wiki.memo.org/MER, MER with a capital M. Fest this past Ohio Linux Fest, I got a t-shirt. Actually, I got two t-shirts. One was a large tilts.org shirt, and the Tilts shirt, this is their new design, the one that I think they were talking about on one of their OLF interviews. It was designed by Richard F. Quarin, who of course is with Screencasters. Everyone knows him. He does all the Linux logo designs now, I think. He did SBOPKG, he did a lot of Linux. No, did he do a lot of Linux? Well, he did Linux Reality, I guess. Lots of that stuff. He did Self, all that good stuff. So, great artist, and really cool t-shirt design. I've literally gotten comments on the t-shirt from people who don't know anything about Linux or anything. They just like the design. They just think it's cool. They don't even understand or care why there's a penguin on it. They're just like, oh, that's a cool shirt. They don't even ask like what Tilts is, or either they already know what it is. Maybe Tilts is more famous than we all realize, or they just don't care. But they do comment on the shirt, and I wear other Linux shirts that don't get comments. So there you go. Anyway, point is, I got a large That one I can kind of fit into. Washed it a couple of times, and I've dried it to try to shrink it down, because it's cottony or something. And that's kind of worked. And it's winter, so I can put something under it, you know, and kind of bulk myself up, and it kind of almost fits. So the large is working for me. The extra large that I somehow got, and I don't know why I have two of these things, and I hope I think it was a mix-up, but an extra large, I can't use it. I've never worn it. Point is that if you, dear listener, email me and tell me what project you will or have donated to. And I don't mean like in the past 3 years. I mean like, you know, either very, very recently, like in the past month, or yesterday, because you just heard this and you decided, oh, I'm going to donate and email him. So, you know, just email me, you know, donate to a good open source project. Email me, let me know what it was and how much you donated. If I get lots of responses, I'll just have to go with the person who donated the most, or the person who donated to the one that I favor. No, I'm just kidding. I will go with whoever donates the most. It doesn't matter what you donate to. If it's OpenOffice, if it's Blender, if it's KDE, if it's that one guy who does all the boot manager work, what is his name, Peter Anvin or something, you know, just whatever, I don't care, just donate to some good kind of open source, you know, project, and let me know what it is and how much you donated, and don't lie, because I'll totally ask for receipts and stuff if I suspect that you are lying, and let me know, and don't bother if you're not anything but extra large, if you know, this is an extra large t-shirt. I'm not going to send you my large. Don't even ask if people comment on this thing. You can definitely have the extra large. So yeah, email me, klaatu@linuxcranks.info or klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org. Recently, I decided that since my triple EPC was kind of undergoing lots of different changes, because basically I was, you know, I had Fedora 12 alpha on the SD card, and then I was going to put Fedora beta 12 on the internal card because I was actually starting to use it and stuff. So it was kind of in flux, and I just kind of decided, you know what, I've been meaning to try BSD again. So I'm going to put BSD on one card. So I put PC BSD on, I want to say the 15 gigabyte or the 16 gigabyte card inside the triple EPC. And then I decided, well, I got that, you know, that 8 gig or the 4 gig, whatever it is, 4 gig, I think, 4 gig card on the inside too, that I could put something. So I decided I'll put OpenSolaris on there. So then, and then I put Fedora 12 beta, I think, on the SD card for a little while, although now it is on the main system, but I'll get to that in a minute. So, about BSD first. Actually, about why on earth one might want to do this. Actually, no. First, let's talk about PC BSD. Then we'll talk about, you know, kind of like what I have learned from my my experience. It'll be like the big moral of the story. So, the BSD thing, I had tried a couple of months ago. I picked up a BSD magazine, and I got kind of annoyed at the magazine because all the screenshots were, or a lot of the screenshots were OS, had OS 10 window decoration, and I don't mean OS 10 like window decoration. I mean they were in OS 10 in a virtual machine. I think it was virtual. What's that one? Not Parallels, but the other one that they do for OS 10. But anyway, and I thought, wow, so they can't even like write a magazine article within their own like OS, and you could argue, well, gee, that is their own OS. It's free BSD. Well, it's not free BSD because it's not a BSD kernel. And anyway, you use an OS 10 box and tell me it's BSD. Believe me, it will change the way that you look at Unix forever. So anyway, that's just my own bias, I guess. But point is, BSD magazine. I tried some BSD. I think it was PC BSD that was bundled with that particular issue. And for whatever reason, it would not install, or it wouldn't run for me. I mean, I tried it on my MacBook, I think, and then I tried it on my Triple E. And both times when I tried to boot, it just wouldn't boot, really. I mean, it would get to the boot manager, and then it would just never proceed, and just random different problems. And I couldn't figure it out, and I still honestly can't figure it out. I don't really know what I did wrong. I'm theorizing at least on the Triple E, possibly, and this is just a theory, and I haven't gone back and, like, tested this rigorously, but I'm wondering if I tried to do some kind of fancy partitioning scheme where it was like the 4 gig and the 8 gig card kind of all on one file system. I mean, I do that often enough on Linux, but maybe I did it wrong on the BSD side of things. So that could have been a problem, because now, I mean, this time, the only thing that I can think I did differently was that I actually just installed PCBSD onto one SD card, one internal SD card. So that might have been the difference. Whatever the difference was, it worked. It actually booted. And I have to say, it's a pretty neat little OS. So PCBSD, if you don't know, is basically, it's not a fork, it's not a version, it is FreeBSD kind of pre-set up for you, basically. You know, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, FreeBSD, if I recall correctly from the one time I did install it, it doesn't boot to X at all. You know, it's a login prompt. I don't think it even has X installed. I think it's X less. So you have to install that, you know, manually from ports or whatever. So that is a big difference, I guess, between PCBSD and FreeBSD. But other than that, I mean, like, in terms of what it is, I mean, it just is FreeBSD. And from what I can tell, it's even more so FreeBSD than, say, Ubuntu is Debian. You know, it is simply FreeBSD configured for you. So there you go. So the long and short of it is that it's quite nice. It uses KDE 4 as its default desktop environment, which is quite nice. But they add some of their own little things to it. So specifically, they have something called PBIs, which are pre-compiled binaries that they offer via some site. I think it's like getpbi.com or something like that, you know, and you go there and you can browse through all their little applications, and you can download them and install them. The really, really cool thing is that of all the installation methods that I have seen, I'm pretty sure that this is probably the finest I've ever witnessed. It was absolutely a beautiful thing. I mean, in terms of like being kind of comfortable and familiar and friendly and stuff, this was beautifully done. So you go to like this getpbi.com or, you know, whatever site it is. I mean, it's linked from PCBSD, their website, so you can get there. But you go here, look through their applications, and you click on an application that you want to download, and it downloads it, and it offers, you know, when KDE's little pop-up dialog, you know, it offers to save it as or open with PBI Manager or whatever, install or whatever, or quit or cancel, whatever. So you can just open it with your PBI installer, and sure enough, a beautiful, just really attractive and friendly-looking PBI installer opens. It's exactly like, you know, in the OS X world when you install something that you actually have to go through an installation process for. It's like that, or it's like on Windows, from what I understand, when you install something, there's like an install wizard or something like that, you know. And this is very, very similar. I mean, it's practically the same thing. A friend told me that, you know, who's used Windows, she told me that it's a lot like the Windows one, because it does things for you. Like, it asks, okay, do you want to create a shortcut for this application on your desktop and or on in your menu, on your application menu? So you can say yes or no to either of those two. You also have the option to launch the application after it's installed. But the way that they do it, I mean, it's its own little application, it's its own little pop-up dialog box with a, you know, the vendor logo, as it were, a little description of the application, and you say next and next and yes, I want to install it here, and all that other good stuff. It's just so friendly and so simple, and it tells you exactly what it's going to do, and you simply click through and you install it, and next thing you know, it's installed and possibly running. So it's really, really friendly. I mean, I've had other distributions. You know, I'll go to getdeb.com or whatever, or, you know, RPM, you know, findrpm.net or, you know, whatever, where you find that application that you need and you can't find it in the repository, but here it is on this site. Maybe it's a direct download from the site, you know, Celtics.com or something. Well, great. The thing is that depending on what browser you're using, depending on what distribution you're using, depending on just a whole host of different things, it seems like what's going to happen after you find it and try to download it is anyone's guess. And I can't tell you how often I'll click on something and it'll offer to open it up in, you know, PackageKit or Synaptics for me. And I'll say, yeah, do that. That'll be cool. That way I can just install it right from here. It'll open it up and then it'll say, oh, you can't install that. I can't install from this kind of package, or you don't have permission to install, you know, whatever. And it always ends up me back on the command line doing some kind of, like, manual install because, for some reason, the GUI stuff just doesn't seem to want to work. And I can't explain it, and, like, again, I haven't rigorously tested it, so I can't say for sure what I did wrong. And it's not really something that I've had a problem with recently. It's more like when I was more new to Linux and just kind of trying to figure out all this kind of stuff. Now, I mean, it is a little bit better, but I mean, if you're going to put this in front of, you know, your mom or your dad and say, okay, here's your new computer and it's running something called Unix, I mean, in terms of installing, you know, they do have a habit of going out to the interwebs and looking for applications, right? Because that's what they do for Windows and Mac. So that part is familiar. So telling them, okay, here's Git PBI, so that's your little shopping cart, you know, that's where you get your applications. They can understand that, you can bookmark that. And then when they actually click it and download, and it says, do you want to open in the PBI installer? And they say, yeah, I want to open it there, and it actually works and does what it's supposed to. That's just a really, really cool thing. So, really, really well done PBI system. Very, very nice. This was really nice. It kind of just jumped out at me as something that I think people would really like, especially people who don't want to ever have to go to the command line and do, you know, some kind of weird command to make a package install. So the PCBSD thing, really, really nice. I had no complaints about it. The port system, I finally kind of got an idea for what that was. I mean, everyone just kind of throws around this term, the port system. Oh, it's like the port system in BSD. Oh, BSD has a port system. I'm just like, okay, great. What's a port system? Well, the port system actually is, it's just like they say. I mean, SBOPKG is a lot like the port system. So you, in BSD, you've got a /USR/port folder, I think, or ports folder. And you go into that folder, and you do like a fetch, or a port fetch, or a fetch port, or something. And that will go out there into the interwebs and find your repository with ports in it. And it copies the entire, you know, the exact directory structure of that port repository into your local, like, directory. You know, it actually takes your you know, it just takes a list of all the files. Obviously, it doesn't take all the source code, but it takes a list of all the files available in the ports directories, and it lists it there in the file tree. So now you've got a folder, USR/ports, full of different directories like games, multimedia, IRC, office, you know, just random stuff, X11, X11-WM, all these different categories. And you can CD into them. You know, you just maneuver around in here. You look around. You find the application that you want to install. You go into that directory. So let's say I wanted to install IRSSI for IRC. So I'd CD into /USR/ports. I'd look around. I'd see one called IRC. So I'd CD into IRC. I'd look around again. I see IRSSI. I see BitchX. I see XChat. You know, all these different applications. I like IRSSI, so I'll go into CD into IRSSI. And once you're here, and you're doing this as root, of course, because you're installing software. So once you're here, you do a make, install, and clean. So you do, you know, you do make, and I guess either the make file or the, maybe this is a special make command, I don't really know, but it actually pulls down the source code from the repository. So it pulls it down for you, it builds the application, it configures and builds it for you, and then it installs it for you, and then it cleans up after itself, i.e. getting rid of all the, you know, extra stuff that you don't really need after you've made it and installed it, you know, just kind of tidying up. If I recall correctly, it keeps the source code in that directory. I could be wrong. Don't quote me on it. I didn't really bother checking. But yeah, it's pretty slick. I liked it. I don't know if there's a front end for it or not. I think there might be. I think later I saw that there was a front end for it. But I just did it all on the command line. It felt good. I liked it. I was impressed. I think I still prefer SBOPKG, but at the same time, like I said, I didn't really investigate front ends for ports, so I could still be wrong about that. But it is pretty slick. I do like it. The Triple EPC I found was not the best platform to compile stuff onto. It seemed like it was going a lot slower than what I was accustomed to, actually. I mean, I know I've compiled stuff on this thing. Now, maybe it was just, you know, I was doing it at work, and so, you know, you kind of set it to compile, and then you get busy and don't really look back, and when you finally do get around to looking back at your Triple E, it's magically done compiling. Okay, it happened so quickly. Well, no, it didn't. It actually took 3 hours, but you just forgot to check back, and it just doesn't seem like that long. So it could have been my imagination, but it really did seem like it was going a lot slower. I mean, I was just trying to install some basics like IRSSI and FreeTalk and, you know, just random little things that I didn't feel should take that long to compile, and it just seemed like it took all day. Compound that with the actual slowness of the system under PCBSD, and I'm not sure why, but there would be moments when I would just randomly, just the mouse would kind of freeze. Not for a long time. It would just noticeably stop working, and then it would start working again. It was almost, it felt to me, in my completely noob opinion, it felt like there was some kind of IRQ cycle, and every, like, so often, my resources were being taken up by some process. You know, maybe it was writing to a swap file, maybe it was reassessing the mouse cursor, I don't know. But it seemed like every so often, it would freeze a little bit. It would just hang up a little bit and then go again. Do I blame this on PCBSD? No, of course not. I am sure that it was my fault. I'm sure that I either chose the wrong kind of file system, or I didn't turn off the swap function, or, you know, something that I did. I know that it was me being a BSD noob that was affecting this, not BSD itself. I'm aware of that. That didn't change the fact that it didn't really seem all that usable to me for my immediate needs, because, you know, unless I wanted to sit there and really, really learn more about PCBSD and stuff, and I do want to, but I don't necessarily have time for that right now. So long and short story would be that, you know, it's no longer on the Triple EPC. But then again, neither is Open Solaris. Why not? Let's talk about that. The other Unix that I've been playing around with lately, I guess, is Open Solaris. And I mentioned this a couple of episodes ago when I first tried. Yeah, so this was like the second time. So this time, for whatever reason, I decided to put it on my Triple EPC. So I booted up the live CD, installed it onto the 4 gig card of my Triple EPC. And it was really, really slow to boot into Open Solaris, and I mean really slow to boot. I mean after the install, I don't mean from the live CD, that I expect, but from the install, you know, it took a long time for it to boot. That's not that big of a deal. I've never really been very concerned with boot times, and I do assume that with some tweakage you could get it down to a faster boot. It's just that I didn't really get to that point, and I'll explain why. But once I got there, you know, again, I like it. I mean, it seems to be working all okay. I don't remember if the sound card was detected or not. I seem to recall it both on my MacBook and my Triple EPC. It might not have detected the sound card, but the wireless was detected. The Atheros cards were detected. I did try a little cool Belinex, it's called, B-E-L-E-N-I-X. It's out of India. It is an Open Solaris distro with, all Open Solaris, but it's got KDE as the default desktop. So I did try that out, but it wouldn't boot from the live CD. It wouldn't get past a certain point. It was an alpha copy of the live CD, so it, you know, that it would not boot was not a surprise. I would probably try that again. I'd give that a shot, but I guess not till it's out of alpha, huh? Anyway, Open Solaris was working pretty good on the Triple EPC. I was pretty happy with it. And then I started kind of trying to learn the package manager, because, you know, that's kind of one of the first things you want to, I guess, become familiar with on a Unix distribution, because you want to probably add some software to it. And I it didn't, because it was a live CD, it didn't really have like a compiler on it at all. So you had to install that if I wanted to just do it all from source. But then I had fears that, you know, a lot of the open source stuff that I'm going to come across on the internet is going to be written really for Linux, and so there might be like serious porting issues that you have to do, which I've run into before, back in the day when I was installing from source on OS X. before I'd actually switched over to Linux, lots of porting issues that, you know, you can sit there and compile it and try to compile it all day, but, you know, if you don't flip this switch and change these lines, then it's just not going to work. So, point is that I was trying to get to know the package manager. The GUI package manager is pretty straightforward. That worked pretty well. But their repository is pretty light. There's not a whole lot in there. So I think I found and installed IRSSI, no problem. But I wanted to get a different desktop because OpenSolaris was running GNOME, and I'm just not a GNOME user, I guess, is what I'll have to face. I figured XFCE4 would probably be pretty cool on there, so I went to look for XFCE4, and I couldn't find it. It wasn't in the repository, so I was going to try to locate it in some other repository, and it was really hard to find another repository. I think I had found one or two the past time. I couldn't find them again this time, so I did find a cool little thing called Wave Blast or Blast Wave, and that seems to be kind of an Open Solaris or a Solaris repository of sorts, but it requires its own special installer, from what I understand. And the installer for that comes in a .pkg format, so that's the packaging format for Open Solaris. And I figured, okay, well, I'll install that with pkg add, or pkg install, whatever it is, I forget now. And I just could not get pkg add or pkg install, I don't remember which one it is, or both probably, to install from a local file. I just could not do it. It would not install from a local file. I read the man page, I looked around, I poked around, could not figure it out. Didn't jump on IRC with that question. I would have, but something's about to drop, and you'll understand why the investigation kind of ceased. So I couldn't get that to work, and yeah, so I was having a little bit of trouble with the package manager. Now, at one point, something I did crashed the computer really, really hard. I plugged in a thumb drive, a USB thumb drive, because I wanted to transfer, I think, a little text file or something over to the Open Solaris. Yeah, it was a text file and some plasmoids, I think. I don't remember why it would have been plasmoids, but it was some text files for sure. And I figured, yeah, I'll pop this in. Plugged the thumb drive in, completely crashed Open Solaris for some reason. I'm pretty sure I've plugged in thumb drives into my MacBook with Open Solaris, so it must have been a weird glitch of some sort, just bad timing, I don't really know. So it crashed it so hard that I had to just power it down manually by, you know, holding the power button or whatever. And so I did that. It held down the power button, turned it off, turned it back on, and Open Solaris was borked. It was gone. It did not exist anymore. It was not functional. So after that, I just decided neither of those two were really working for me all that much, you know, and again, it's just one of those cases where if I really wanted to and if I had the time, I could sit down and figure it out further and stuff like that, but I don't have the time. You know, I've got other stuff going on, so I decided that the day or two that I spent playing around with those was just going to have to be enough for now, and more serious tests will have to occur some other time, you know, maybe next season or something, I don't know, whenever I get the time to set up a box and actually compare this to this to this to this, where this equals Linux kernel, BSD kernel, Solaris kernel, and Darwin kernel, respectively. Then I think that that's just going to have to be it for now, which is a pity, because, get ready for the moral, here it comes, because exploring other Unixes and Unix-like systems is actually really, really cool, and really, really fun, and informative. That was the moral right there. So if you're into Unix and Unix-like systems, which I think probably most of us are, and I feel a little bit ambivalent toward the concept, because on the one hand, you know, Unix with a capital U, where that would be like Solaris and a little bit of BSD, you kind of get the sense that it is almost proprietary. I mean, it's not, but it feels, or I guess Solaris kind of is. I mean, you know, it's not. Okay, here's what I mean. It's not a GPL. It's not GPL. That's all I mean right there. It's not GPL. So you think, well, am I really just wanting to use Unix, or am I wanting to use GNU? Which, you know, GNU is not Unix. So what are you really, you know, what are you doing? You're doing do you like Unix-like, or do you like Unix copywritten by, you know, Bell Labs, copywritten by SCO, copywritten by Novell, copyright by ? You know, I mean, someone owns this stuff, and I don't know how free it is or how open it is or whatever terminology you want to use. See, having said that, getting, you know, sitting down and experiencing the port system on BSD and saying, ah, so that's what everyone's talking about when they say Slackware is BSD-like. Or starting to really dig into Slackware and understand that everything really is just simple, you know, shell scripts and text files and stuff like that. You know, how they built up this whole Unix-like system. So there's some pretty cool stuff going on with distributions and distributions broadly, meaning other Unixes, and looking at that bigger picture sometimes is interesting. But historically speaking, and kind of getting to know the family, looking at the other Unixes is pretty cool, I think. You really get a feel for how other people are implementing these Unix ideals, and how some other things are not implementing the Unix ideals. PCBSD and OpenSolaris, both highly recommended, or FreeBSD for that matter, highly recommended. I would check them out and kind of play around with them for a little while, just to see how these other systems are kind of putting themselves together, or being put together. And, yeah, it's an interesting study, so check them out. Well, it sounds like it's got to be time for a cup of coffee, so this episode being the last in the season might as well just go on and on and on. So I'm just going to keep going until I run out of things to say for this episode. So grab a cup of coffee, make it a big one, and we'll come right back for just more stuff. So the other big Unix experiment that I tried on the Triple EPC after I decided, okay, PCBSD and OpenSolaris weren't working for me in that time, for whatever reason, I decided to go the complete opposite direction and go with TinyCore Linux, which is a really, really fascinating project. I mentioned it on Linux Cranks a couple of weeks ago, and I just have to mention it again here. So on the 4 gig partition, I put TinyCore. On the 15 gig, I put Fedora 12 beta. So now I'm booting, you know, primarily Fedora 12 on the Triple E, and I got TinyCore on the 4 gig. And the TinyCore project is really, really fascinating, really, really interesting. I highly recommend you check this out. It is complex, so do not expect it to be a walk in the park, I guess. But it is really, really interesting nevertheless. And I think it's really important just in light of saying, okay, you know, it's cool to try other distributions and learn more about Unix and Unix way of doing things and the different flavors that Unix kind of comes into being as, the different incarnations of the Unix ideal. TinyCore takes it to a really interesting sort of corner of the ring. I don't even know where to begin. So TinyCore apparently must have a Linux kernel, right? Okay, so that's where it gets the Linux part of its name, the kernel. And it's truer now, I think, than ever. You know, that you put BusyBox on top of Linux, and through a couple of other packages on there, and that's it, you know, and that's TinyCore. And I think it's a 10 megabyte download, so it happens. It probably would download for you faster than this episode downloaded for you. I mean, it's tiny. It is small. So I booted it onto the Triple E. It takes no time to boot. It is a 3-second boot or something ridiculous like that. Maybe 5, maybe 10, I don't know. But it takes no time to boot. I was amazed. And then you have a little desktop, believe it or not, with a little dock at the bottom. And you have, I think, 3 different choices. You've got a terminal, you've got a package manager, a preferences settings, or something like that. And you can utilize this live image that you're running right then and there to actually install it to some type of media. And on their website, they have a very good step-by-step tutorial on how to do that, how to make that happen. And you can install it to anything: USB drive, SD card, internal SD card, or SD drive, whatever it would be called, just whatever, a CD, whatever you want. And actually, I don't know how you can do it to a CD, but anyway, the other stuff you can do. And then you can sit there and actually decide what applications you want to install onto your little tiny distribution. So you can start out with TinyCore. You can put Fluxbox on top of it, or probably Window Maker, I would imagine. Slap that on there. You can put some of your favorite applications on there. And it's really cool because they have a little repository of little tiny packages that are self-contained binaries of different applications. So very much like Slacks, I guess, you can download this thing that is really, really small, and in this case it's really small, it's 10 megabytes, whereas Slacks is 100 megabytes or 200 megabytes. I mean, it's got a KDE desktop, it's got a lot of drivers built into it and stuff like that. Well, not a lot, but a couple. So it's a little bit larger. But then you can grab the Slack modules, the Slack packages, whatever they, modules I think is what they call them, and throw them into a folder on your little Live Media and tell the Live Media, okay, this folder is my extensions folder, my module folder. You look in there for all the stuff that I want, you know, that you'll give me access to once I boot you up, and it works like that. Well, Tiny Core, from what I can tell, works pretty much the same way. Now, unfortunately, during my initial install, I didn't understand that this was the case, and I didn't really understand the process. So I had installed a lot of the applications that, in actuality, I would want it on a different partition. I installed it kind of into the main system, which really slowed my boot down by a good, you know, 5 or 6 seconds. So that's kind of a bummer, and I'll probably have to do a reinstall unless I can figure out how to reassign the what they call the TC local, I think. So yeah, I've got a little bit of issues there, but that was my fault from not understanding it. But yeah, the idea is here that you've got BusyBox and Linux, and that's pretty much it. So you can install Bash. So I installed Bash pretty early on, and then I installed like a sound system, you know, OSS and also, I think, both of those. And I installed just, you know, random things, really. I mean, I wasn't really clear on what I was doing, so I just kind of threw in a whole bunch of stuff. But basically, all you are doing is you're downloading these little, I think they're they used to be TCL and TCX, and now they're kind of carving it down, whittling it down to just TCX packages. And these are, like I said, self-contained binaries. And making them is apparently very easy. I was going to create a TCX package for Emacs, and I just haven't gotten around to it. And looking at the shell scripts that they kind of give you as a template, it is pretty complex. But the idea is fairly simple, and it's not unlike Slack builds. It's you're simply taking this thing, and you're compiling it into a dest dir, that is, you know, a destination directory that is all kind of self-contained. It's not spread throughout the system like a normal make install would do. So you're kind of like consolidating all the build, and I guess you're not using any shared libraries, I assume. I don't really know, but all that kind of stuff. And then when you boot, you're telling, it's almost the sort of the difference between like slash user bin and slash user local bin, you know, because like if you put user bin on a different partition, then when you're booting up, it wouldn't be able to find the binaries that it needs to mount that partition, you know, so it wouldn't be able to ever access user bin, and your system wouldn't boot. Well, I'm saying different partition than your root partition. So if you've got a root and then you say, oh, I'm going to put user bin over on, you know, SDB, well, you can do that in theory, except, like I say, it won't work, so don't do it. But you could put user local bin over on another partition, because that's not vital to the boot process or to the initialization process of your system. So you can do that, because by the time it gets through mounting everything in fstab, then, you know, then it's okay, because then it won't need anything in user local bin until it's mounted that partition. So, I mean, I don't think it will need anything in user local bin unless you have some kind of thing installed that you installed to user local bin, and you've got something in rc.d referencing user local bin, I guess. But my point being that, you know, typically you don't want to do that. So same goes for Tiny Core. If you've got this folder that you're allowed to start installing packages into, and it's called the TC Local, I think, or TC Home, either TC Home or TC Local, and all your applications, all the little modules that you download via their repository, all these little self-contained binaries get dumped into there by default. So when you're booting, it's going to look for that TC Local or TC Home, whatever. And if you've got all your packages in there, then it's going to go through that list of packages and say, yep, okay, I've got this, 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 and that's happening during your boot period. And I don't believe you obviously do not need to have packages in there during boot. So if you want a faster boot, you'll leave that alone and set your TC local or TC home, whatever, to a separate portion of your system. So that's what I didn't do, and that's what I will have to do at some point. I might just symlink, like move the things and then put a symlink in where TC local used to be to the new TC local. I'll see if that works, although I'm not sure if that will work, because it still might try to, it'll probably still scan that directory and try to load all the applications into RAM or whatever. But if you keep it small enough, or if you simply, like I say, get your packages out of the initialization path, then the whole thing boots into RAM. Everything just goes straight to system RAM, so the thing runs like it's incredible. I've never seen such fast response time in everything that I launch. You know, it's really nice. So again, there, I guess you might want to put your most commonly used applications in that initialization path so that, yeah, they are there in RAM and you can use them. I guess that could be an advantage of that. But yes, very interesting little distribution. To me, it seems a lot like Slack's, only exponentially smaller. So it's very, very fast. It would be ideal, I imagine, for two reasons. One would be because, you know, if you don't want to have to, with Slack's, you have so much pre-installed, right? And with any small live distribution, you're going to have certain things pre-installed. I mean, even SLTAS, which is pretty small, or damn small Linux, or DSL, whatever they're calling it now, or Puppy, you know, I mean, they've all got their little pre-installed applications, which are great, but maybe you don't want those pre-installed set of applications. Maybe you want a different set of applications, or whatever. Then looking at TinyCore and kind of building it up yourself might be a good idea. The other thing that it would be ideal for, I guess, is just a really, really customized portable distro. You know, I mean, it's right there. You can put it on a thumb drive, it will take no room, and it boots really fast, and it's not going to get hung up on lots of fancy things that it's going to try to implement. It's just, it's the bare basics. Well done, but it's just the basics. So that is, it's a really cool little little distribution. I would definitely look at it. It's really kind of neat because if you look deep enough, you start to really see in any Linux distribution, I think there is a lot going on that we don't quite understand until you strip it all away and you're just kind of looking at, wow, that's the bare minimum, huh? Interesting. So check it out for sure. It's really cool. It's TinyCore Linux. I don't know the website, but I'll put it in show notes. And you can search for it online too. World of Goo. Everyone likes World of Goo. It's a puzzle game that came out a while ago now. It was for Mac and PC originally, I guess. And then at some point, and I'm not really sure when exactly, but at some point they came out with a version for Linux. And it was a native version for Linux. I guess that was a big deal as well. I mean, anytime a game decides to release a native version for Linux, I mean, that's a big deal. That's significant because they're doing something that isn't necessarily, I don't know, I guess in the business model of things, you know, it's not, I guess technically speaking, you just don't have the same kind of audience that you have for Windows. The Mac and Windows version was on the same disk, so that was there. And then they came out with a Linux version, which I guess was just on their website. I never saw a disk for it, but maybe I wasn't looking for one either. But I do have a friend who had bought the version for Mac and Windows, so I saw the disk for that, and the Linux version was not on that disk. I can confirm that. So whenever they came out with the Linux version, I don't know if it sold well or whatever, but it was cool that they did it. Now, the fact that they did this, the fact that the Mac and the Windows version kind of coexisted from the beginning, and then the Linux version was followed very shortly thereafter, says to me that whatever they did this in must have been somewhat cross-platform. I don't know anything about game programming. I don't know anything about DirectX versus, or ActiveX versus Core Graphics versus CL, OpenCL versus OpenGL, you know, just whatever. Know nothing about all that stuff. But apparently, I mean, this is a fairly small company. It's like an independent game company, or not independent. Well, yeah, I mean, they're small, you know, they're not like a division of EA or anything, or AE or whatever that one company is. You know, it's like, it's their own company. It's 2D Boy, I think is what it's called. So it's the small-time guys, you know? And yet they were able to produce a Mac and a Windows and a Linux version of this game. So this means to me that they probably didn't sit down and reprogram the whole thing from the ground up on three separate occasions. That's probably not how it happened. Whatever they did looks great. It looks fantastic on Mac, Windows, and Linux, and I can now say that I've seen it on all three. I have seen it play on a MacBook running macOS 10 Leopard. I've seen it on Windows XP or Vista, I don't remember which one, and I've seen it on Linux, Fedora and Slackware on two separate laptops. So, and one of those laptops was the same that was running the Windows version as well. So that's like three different laptops and I guess four different OSs, I guess, if you say Fedora and Slackware are different OSs, which for the purpose of this, we'll say it is. They are. So the point is, it looks the exact same on each different platform. It goes full screen. It has this beautifully smooth and really nice looking animation, and it's got this sort of really high production value music and all that other good stuff. And it really is quite nice for what? I mean, I was going to say for a game, but then I realized I don't really know anything about games and what they're supposed to look like. But to me, it looked really nice. You know, I mean, I was impressed when I saw it and heard it. I was like, wow, this is really kind of unique looking. And the fact that it runs that well on all three platforms and it's native and all that other good stuff means to me that they must have been using something that, you know, was lowest common denominator enough or cross-platform enough that they could actually apparently just kind of port it fairly quickly over to the different platforms. And I really wonder, you know, what's keeping other games from doing the same thing, and it's probably got something to do with the 3D rendering and the way it talks to the graphics cards and stuff like that. And you know, again, I don't know anything about it, so I can't really comment on it. But I do wonder if there isn't something out there that can do, or that could be developed to do, you know, a more cross-platform kind of gaming system. And I'm sure there probably is, and I think that doing that would be a really, really cool thing. I don't think any company is going to bother doing it. I think that a lot of companies probably are kind of set in their ways, and they see, okay, well, we've got this system and it seems to work for us, so we're going to keep doing it. I guess until someone else gets a market solid enough that they can see, you know, in their marketing department that, okay, this group of people want to buy the games, but they're not running Windows, so what can we do about that? Then they would probably change and or develop something to where it will be that platform that does work on, you know, these two major market shares or these three major market areas. But yes, anyway, so I wish it was OpenGoo, it's World of Goo. World of Closed Goo had a little celebration of their birthday or something, and they were selling a copy of it for whatever you want to pay. And I got a copy, and my friend got a copy because she'd already bought the Mac and Windows version, but she needed the Linux version now because ever since Ohio Linux Fest, she'd switched to Fedora. So she grabbed a copy and installed it onto her formerly Windows running notebook, now running Fedora 11, and it plays exactly the same. I mean, it is exactly the same. It frankly worked better in terms of, like, taking an application and installing it on you know, same application on a different platform. I mean, it worked every time, whether it was her brief experiment with OS 10, whether it was her going back to XP or Vista or Fedora, it worked. I mean, it was basically the same process each time. It was really, really cool. It was really nice. It just installed easily. And you launch it, and it does the same thing. It goes full screen, and it shows you some animation or whatever it does. You know, it's just, it's a really well put together game, and just the multi-platformness of it is really, really impressive to me. I've seen things that are supposed to work on all three platforms, but not this way, never in this way. I mean, even like something like Picasa or OpenOffice, even there are little differences here and there that just kind of, I don't know, they feel different enough to me as a dumb user knowing nothing of programming to think, oh, they must have really had to kind of like hack around something to get here or to get there. Whereas this one, yeah, you launch it on any three platform and it just. It bang, it's up, it's the exact same way as it was on your other platform. The exception there, I guess, would be Blender. That feels the same every time I launch that, no matter what platform it's on. But World of Goo was an interesting kind of view into a commercially, you know, native Linux game. Performance-wise, it was really good. I can't complain. And like I say, it worked on a lot of different ATI card, a Intel Intel 9, like 65 or whatever those are on the MacBook, and then an Intel Mobile 4 on another computer, on another notebook, a Lenovo. So it really, I mean, across the spectrum in terms of like graphic capabilities and stuff, it really worked well. Yeah, if you get a chance to take a look at it, it's worth checking out. Definitely interesting to take a look at. Okay, listener feedback, and I've got quite a few listener feedbacks that I need to catch up on, so I'm just going to keep going through these until I get to the end. If you have given me feedback and I haven't responded via email, that is an oversight on my part. I might very feasibly overlook your feedback when reading it on the show, because I just lose track of feedback emails. I've tried to implement organizational methods to keep track of them, and I don't, because I end up replying to people, and then I pull the reply and lose the track of the original, or just all kinds of weird things. So not very well organized in the feedback realm, but I do typically email you back. So if you've emailed me and I have not emailed back, that's a mistake. Either re-email me or ping me or yell at me or something, and I will respond. If I'm missing it on the show, it's nothing against you. I probably just misplaced it. But yeah, that's sort of the story behind all that. So in terms of, let's see who this is. This is, I think, yeah, Basic Tracks from, I think, the Netherlands. I could be mistaken, but he's a guy who's been kind of helping me a lot with the Slacker Media project. He came up with a really good Rose Garden tutorial and stuff, which I still have not checked. I want to try his suggestions and see what happens, and then write it up and put it on the Slacker Media site, and I just haven't done that yet. He also wrote an interesting shell script that kind of scours your system and sees exactly what is installed in terms of applications. And he sent me that shell script, and I'm going to post that on Slacker Media as a special Slacker Media-only shell script that you can get. And it's a cool little shell script. I mean, it's just basically just doing, like, what is all on your user bin, user S bin, user local bin, stuff like that. So it's handy, though. I added a date stamp to it and some folders that I have applications in that I guess aren't really the default, so he didn't feel like it should be added to the actual final product, but I did do the date stamp, and then I think I added some switch on his sorting. Yeah, I did. In fact, I the way he sorts the list kind of threw me off, so I told it to, like, disregard capitalization or something like that. But it was a good little shell script. Look for it eventually on Slacker Media. But for now, he's talking about a YouTube link, which I'm not going to read to you because it's 32 characters of random, practically random characters. But the point is that it's, you can also search for Richard Buckland on YouTube, and they are filmed lectures from a programming course at some university somewhere, and some guy on a Dutch Linux forum recommended it to Basic Tracks some time ago, and he says it's really good. He says it's worth it. So I might check those out. Will I install Flash in order to check those out? You never know, do you? You just never know. So that's cool. That's neat. Thank you for that, Basic Tracks. That is always helpful information. I do appreciate it. Dan Washko from the Linux Link Tech Show, the show of which the t-shirt I am using as a contest prize now, he emailed me and said that Slackware 13 is on his server. It's all good, he says. So that's really cool. He's got Slackware 13 on his, you know, server, which that's pretty cool. I wish I had a server that I knew how to use well enough to just load up Slackware 13 on it and email people excitedly. But I will get there. I will get there eventually. I've got the server. I just need to really sit down and play around with it. So, yeah, there is that. Let's see. Dave Yates wrote me. I guess this is like the other podcaster thread. So Dave Yates emailed me and said that, I had emailed him, actually, because on his, I think it was episode 120, he was really, really talking a lot about how horrible GTK applications looked in a Qt-based environment or something like that. I don't exactly remember the problem, but it was definitely some issue of trying to integrate GTK and Qt stuff and how GTK looked horrible. And he kept saying it looked really, really bad. So I emailed him, and I mean, at first I just kind of glossed over it, okay, whatever, but he kept going on about it on his show, and I was like, you know what, I wonder if he's seeing what I think he's seeing, because it sounds like he is. So there's an issue, you know, in a distro where you're configuring it yourself, that it's not necessarily the case that someone has installed Qt GTK engine, or the GTK Qt engine or something like that. I think it's Qt GTK engine, and or it could be the other way around. Point is, it's some kind of engine that enables GTK stuff to be rendered properly in the Qt environment. And so I asked him about, you know, for a screenshot, and he sent me a screenshot, and sure enough, it was exactly what I thought I saw when, you know, what I thought it would be. And it was exactly what I used to see before I knew to install GTK Qt engine. So I told him about it, and I think he said that he had it installed, but it wasn't making a difference. And I think I'm wondering if there's some issue of because he's not actually running KDE, there's no place in system settings to say, yes, implement the GTK engine and make it look like this and stuff like that. So I'm not really sure I'm not really sure what the problem is exactly, and I'm not really sure what the solution would be. I have a feeling it's some config file in a KDE folder somewhere switching on the GTK engine options or setting the GTK engine to a certain theme or something like that. But I can't really reproduce his problem in the same way that he's having it, so I can't really figure it out. But I haven't listened. I don't know if he's come up with episode 121 at the time of this recording yet. I haven't checked lately. I need to check and see if that's out and see if he's hacked away on this anymore and kind of fixed it or something. So I'm going to, I'll check that out as soon as possible. Deep Geek wrote me, and I guess he was in on the thread with Dave Yates. See, I told you this was like the other podcaster's thread. He was in on it with Dave Yates. I guess I'd copied him or something like that. But he was saying that the Qt engine works a lot better for me than anything he had ever tried either. So I don't really know. Maybe the GTK Qt engine is something that KDE implements. And so if you're using Qt apps without, well, no, that wouldn't make sense. I don't know. I don't know where, I don't know enough about this kind of thing to know where, the order of this stack and how to get the GTK thing to be kind of swept up in the whole Qt stack. So don't really know much about it. But Deep Geek also recommends something called YACPI, YACPI, YACPI. And this is supposed to be some kind of other ACPI manager, for power management, battery notification and stuff that you don't need a GUI for, which I'm very excited to learn about. So I haven't tried it yet, but I'm probably going to try it as soon as possible, because there have been many, many times go out to a cafe or something and there's no reason to start X at all. I will not have X going. I'll simply be doing like a tutorial on something, typing it up. You don't need X for that. But sometimes I have to run X simply because I need to know, is the battery monitor, where's my battery? So that's really annoying to have to do, have to run X just for a battery monitor. So hopefully YACPI, YACPI, will help with that. I have not tried it. I did go to the site. I read up on it. I got scared because it sounded like it might replace, some other thing that I'm using. On further reflection, I don't think that would be the case, so I will probably try it very soon. Deep Geek also told me, and this is all, I think this is all in alphabetical order, that's why it just so happens that Dan, Dave Yates, and Deep Geek all start with D. So Deep Geek wrote me and said that the old Patrick McGoohan series, The Prisoner, has been remade into a mini-series that's going to premiere on AMC TV on the 15th. I know of The Prisoner. I think I probably saw an episode once by chance. It looked really intriguing. I'd read up on it a while ago, not recently, and it sounded intriguing. It did sound like something that probably didn't deserve to be a TV series. It'll probably work a lot better as a miniseries, so I would love to check this out. I don't have a television. I do not have a television with AMC-TV. I think AMC is the American Movie Channel or something. No, the American Movie Classics or something. So it all sounds really cool, and I'll probably check it out as soon as it's, on Netflix or Torrents or something. I'll probably try to check that out. Sounds really neat. Deep Geek wrote me again and said that he really enjoyed episode 419, which was the one about Q-Tractor, and I talked about MIDI and stuff. He cites Tubular Bells, which, of course, is by, I'm pretty sure, Jean-Michel Jarre, right? Or is it just Jean-Michel Jarre, or Michel Jarre. I don't know what his name is, I forget. I should know that off the top of my head. For some reason I'm blanking right now, but you know who I'm talking about, Tubular Bells. Apparently it became the soundtrack of some movie. I'm not really sure which one. Deep Geek didn't know, and I didn't bother looking it up, but I didn't know that about it. But I knew that Tubular Bells is a really famous album and stuff like that. I have not listened to much of Jarre's work. Nothing against him at all. It's just I've got a lot of other music that I listen to, and he just didn't make a cut early enough to be one of the people that I follow. So, but I do know of him, and yeah, he's like one of those one-man kinds of deals, and I'm sure he used MIDI quite a bit, at one point, and probably still does now in a in sort of the new incarnation of it. I mean, MIDI traditionally was kind of known for being very stilted and stunted and Kraftwerkian, you know, but that's not necessarily the case. It just depends on how you use it, to what extent you use it as well. DeepGeek said, and this is kind of interesting, that he's a big fan of the harpsichord, and actually so am I, but DeepGeek, I guess, favors Scarletti. I thought it was Scarlatti, but maybe it's Scarletti, I don't know. It's some Italian guy who does a lot of harpsichord stuff, did a lot of harpsichord stuff, and he said that one of the ways that he used to get some of Scarletti's pieces were as MIDI files back in, you know, back when it was more like, you know, downloading a 45 kilobyte file was, you know, took a few moments rather than, you know, now a web page that's 45K is small. So he would literally get it, you know, on, you know, wherever he could find those MIDI files on, like, the old dial-up, you know, connections and stuff. So that was kind of interesting. I'd never really thought about that. I mean, I knew that MIDI pieces were bandied about, but I never really thought of it for that kind of use, and that's actually pretty cool. That's pretty neat. That's actually really cool. And for whatever reason, I guess, I mean, in a way, classical music and MIDI are interestingly intertwined, because I guess there's that kind of, what was it, Glenn Gould kind of theory, you know, that all classical music should be perfect, you know, perfectly timed and perfectly played, and there's no room for delay and stuff, you know, or there is room for delay, but it should be perfectly calculated, you know, this kind of sort of striving for perfection, and what could be more perfect than saying, okay, here's a MIDI file, and it has all the data within it to reproduce this piece exactly how it should be, you know, repeated, so that there's never any variation in that. So I think that was Glenn Gould who was all about that. I could be wrong. But yeah, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like classical music, math, and MIDI. It's all kind of like, they kind of flirt from time to time with one another. So that was an interesting email, an interesting kind of way of seeing things. Jonathan wrote me, and he said that he was really enjoying the Slackware episodes, and he's probably going to be running Slackware for a while. He found that it wasn't, you know, as hard as everyone makes it out to be, which I agree with. I totally agree with. I think that Slackware frequently gets a bad rap for whatever reason. So yeah, the Slackware stuff is a lot of fun, you know, and it's every time I see it and see how things are done with all the shell scripts and the plain text files and all that other stuff, so Unix-y. So beautiful, so wonderful. So Jonathan's digging it. He's probably going to keep it around for a while. He did write me with a question about the NVIDIA video drivers. He was trying to install the non-free NVIDIA drivers, which I guess he needed in order to run GNOME, in order to run Orca. So kind of a weird, he doesn't really even need, Kajari from IRC complains about this a lot, you know? I mean, he doesn't need the graphics, he just needs graphics, you know, because he has to have it in order for Orca to work, which I can imagine is a real, I mean, it seems stupid. I mean, it's kind of like me running X just for a battery monitor, you know, I mean, it feels like overkill. But anyway, Jonathan needed the NVIDIA drivers, and he had a question about it. He was trying to run, apparently, I guess, NVIDIA and ATI both, when you go to download their proprietary drivers, they give you a shell script, essentially. It's a something, you know, NVIDIA-driver-install-linux-run, I think. So it's a shell script, and you might need the chmod plus x, this shell script. And then you should be able to launch it by becoming root, and then do a .nvidia-install-run, and that will execute the shell script. You could run it as non-root, but I since it's installing video drivers, I'm assuming you need to be root. As long as it's chmodded plus x, that's making, you know, it's changing the file to be executable. So that's what you probably need to do. And he got it installed or not. I don't remember if he went with, I think he didn't know about the non-free one. So in the Slackware default install, there should be, or there is, unless you've excluded it, the xf86-nv-videodriver.tgz or whatever. So unless you specifically went in there and said, okay, don't install that video driver, it'll be installed in your default Slackware, so it should go ahead and work, I would think. Of course, maybe he has an updated card that isn't covered by the NV driver, and he had to use a proprietary version. I really don't know. I don't remember what he said, yeah, because I asked him about it in an email, and he did write me back. But all in all, I mean, the end result is that he's really liking Slackware and finds it really, really good, a really good system. He's really enjoying it, so that's what he's going to be running for a while, I guess, which is cool. Join the club, Jonathan. Let's see. He said, okay, here's his other email. He says, I only use the NVIDIA driver because I wasn't sure where to get the open driver. And yeah, like I say, the open driver, it should be installed by default on Slackware. If it's not, then you should be able to add it with Slack package, Slack PKG. And if that doesn't work, it's probably, you know, some kind of video driver problem. And you can do, there's a shell script sort of thing for Zorg. But it's like xconfig, or I haven't had to run it in a long time, actually, so I don't really actually know it off the top of my head. And it is just a little shell script, I think, you know, within the Zorg package or Zorg utilities that will kind of reconfigure which... No, actually, you know what? It's a Slackware. It's one of those two things. So there is a... I can't remember what it is, and I'm not in front of an internet connection right now. But there is a little shell script in there that you can run to reassign, you know, what you want to use for your Zorg driver. And if it's not installed, then Slack PKG install xf86-nv-video-driver-something-something-something.tgz. That's sort of it. Thoth from IRC and some other places, I guess, wrote me. He's really doing a lot to try to help me with this Blender idea, and unfortunately, I feel lost enough that I don't know even where to begin on the whole Blender project. Thoth is kind of thinking Python could work for the Blender interface, and it sounds slow to me, but I don't know anything about it, so, you know, it's just a lot to think about, a lot to figure out. And unfortunately, I've been pretty short on time lately, which, you know, just between work and finding work and all that other good stuff. So the idea is not dead. It's still going. I just need to sit down and dedicate some more time on it. He says that, I mean, right now is a bad time to do this anyway, because 2.5 is coming out. It's they're doing a lot of the development on Blender 2.5. They're at 2.49a right now. So it's kind of a weird sort of like, you know, they're rewriting a lot of the Python plugin architecture and stuff like that. It's supposed to be a lot better, but at the same time, it's also changing a lot. So, yeah, it's kind of a weird time in Blender's life cycle right now. Anyway, that's not what he wrote me about. He was writing me about Transmission, which is the distribution from Ron Stewart, who I interview, I think, in the second or third season, again, The Bad Apples. And he does the Indamix project, you know, the one where it's like a touchscreen little computer. It's actually a Samsung, I think. And it's got this custom distribution on it called Transmission. And it's really slick. And I saw it when it was still on his customized hardware that he actually built himself. And he's transitioned over to Samsung, you know, stuff that they're making because they can make it cheaper than he can. And that kind of brought the price down a bit and stuff like that. So that's working pretty well. And they recorded a lot of the interviews and stuff at scale on this device. And it's a really great little distribution for multimedia. And Thoth makes a good point. It's really well put together. It's really nicely put together. If you can buy a dedicated computer with multimedia, or rather audio system on it, that is the way to go. Absolutely. It's slick. It is out of the box, works. Integrated is just really, really well done. And Ron works a lot with developers of the different, you know, Audacity and Ardor and stuff, and Jack, to make sure that everything actually does talk to each other and optimized for Jack. And just, it really does work together, and it's really, really nicely done. Can't really say enough about it that it's good. I mean, it's just so good. I did some early, like, work on the graphics for it. And actually, Skrillet did some of the website work, the website graphics for Ron, for Transmission. So somewhere on there, there's some graphics that Skrillet did. Point is, it's a really cool distribution. Highly recommended. If you can swing that, that's a very good way to get a multimedia, you know, Linux distribution kind of going for you. Rain from France emailed me, said that the last couple of episodes of Linux Cranks had some weird sort of choppy sounds and stuff like that. Like, I don't really know what exactly, but yeah, some poor sound quality. And I told her, of course, that I have nothing to do with the recording or the editing of Linux Cranks, and I wasn't really sure what was going on. I'm guessing it's TalkShoe, and after I guessed that, she kind of agreed. TalkShoe is not the best service in the world, but it is a service, and it works. So, you know, it's really hard. It's been hard to get a good, reliable way of recording a bunch of people calling in, you know, onto some kind of conference. And you have to find the conference room itself. You know, there's a lot of logistics going on there. And I'm sure there are great ways to do it. It's just you have to set it up or you have to buy stuff or whatever. So TalkShoe is just kind of like a really easy and fairly reliable way to do it. So a lot of people are still using it. TalkShoe, I have some issues with because the Flash interface just doesn't seem to want to work all that well on my computers. So then I'll go to a friend's computer, but now most of my friends are running Linux, so I'm still having a hard time. Yeah, not having the greatest luck with TalkShoe lately anyway, so I'm trying to avoid it as much as possible. Ron sent me an email again about Emacs Foo, or rather, again, Ron sent me an email, this time about Emacs Foo, which is similar to, what was it, like command line Foo or bash Foo or something like that, but emacs-foo.blogspot.com is the site, and it is a site full of, obviously, kind of like cool tricks for Emacs. Emacs is a program that I feel like I kind of halfway know because I kind of know a lot of the, you know, the common keyboard shortcuts for bash, just simple things like Control A, Control E, Control, that's actually all I know. Well, no, Control F, Control B, Control N, Control P, you know, all the normal, I guess, simple, Control C even, all the simple kinds of basic commands. So I feel like a transition to Emacs would not be hard, and I do want to learn it better, simply because Emacs is such a fully featured program, and I really think it's a good thing to know, and I have a pretty strong interest in it for something called Emacs Speak, and that is a screen reader for Emacs, essentially, meaning that in theory, I figure one could live inside of Emacs practically and get by probably fairly well. I've heard it's really good. I just haven't gotten around to actually playing around with this enough to really make a definitive decision about whether that's a viable option for someone who wants to use Linux but does not have sight. And there's a few people that I know who do want to do that, and I keep thinking, and they're kind of agreeing with me, that trying to superimpose the screen reader onto a graphical environment just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. So the less you have to do in a graphical environment and try to force a screen readability option onto that, it seems like the better off you would be. Whether or not this is true, or if Emacs Speak is where it needs to be a really fully functional screen reader for like day-to-day tasks, I don't know. But I do know just from doing things, the few things that I do in Nano, for instance, which of course shares a lot of the same keyboard shortcuts as well, and kind of, I think, is, you know, shares a lot of the kind of ideas of Emacs, is, or the sort of the, you know, the way that it opens up a file browser right there in your workspace, things like that. It is, I think in theory, it could be really good. It certainly has a smoothness and a flow to it for the way that you use it with sight. So I'm thinking it might be good for sightless usage as well with a screen reader, because it's all plain text. And what's simpler for a screen reader to convey than plain text? I think Ron was also the one who emailed me a link to ajax.org. And if you go to ajax.org, you'll see some pretty fantastic and pretty fascinating animation on the site. This, I guess, is an ironic link to have right after I was just talking about plain text. But in terms of internet, and I guess, you know, Web 2.0, and all that other good stuff, if I had to choose between Ajax and Flash, obviously I'd be definitely taking Ajax over Flash. Because at least then you got code in the background that you can look at or sort through or sift through or maybe parse. Whereas Flash, I mean, it may as well just not exist. It's just not on the radar of a plain text browser. So it's kind of nice to have the Ajax option there. You know, it's all the bling without the proprietariness and without the sort of lockout that you get with Flash. So yeah, Ajax is pretty neat. I don't know half as much about JavaScript and all that other good stuff as I should or as I want to, but I have seen some pretty impressive things done without the involvement of any kind of Flash or proprietary thing. It's just all done with code, and it generates it within the browser. It's really, really cool. So check out ajax.org sometime if you haven't ever been there. It's kind of nice. Ron also sent me a Gopher site that is it's called the Overbyte Project, bringing Gopher back to today's operating systems and browsers. I don't know the history of Gopher. I don't know where it came from or when it started or I guess what it is, even. I mean, it's it's not HTTP, right? It's Gopher. The difference between that and HTTP or FTP or whatever, I really couldn't tell you. But I do know that it's just really a lot of text-based kind of stuff that generally is, you know, it's just got really cool stuff. I think I have a Gopher site somewhere through the sdf.lonestar.org shell account that I have. So it's kind of neat and definitely worth checking out. The Overwrite project is basically kind of bringing Gopher support into modern things like Firefox. I guess Firefox must have some kind of support for Gopher, which I didn't actually know, but I guess it's not as good as they want it to be. So there is a Firefox, no, it's Gopher FF, I think is what they're calling it. No, Overwrite FF, which is the sort of the replacement Gopher plugin or whatever for Firefox. There's some kind of standalone Gopher client coming up out of Adobe Air. I guess they're programming it in Adobe Air so that it'll run on all the different OSs and just random stuff like that. So you can go to the site itself by going to gopher://gopher.floodgap.com/1/Overwrite. That would be the direct link. I will have to include that in some show notes. You can also just go to http://gopher.floodgap.com/overwrite. But if you want to see the Gopher version, you know, like in Lynx or eLink or whatever text browser you use, that would be the way to get there. Ron also kindly told me that Klaatu, K-L-A-A-T-U, has been suggested as a name for Fedora 13. And no, it has nothing to do with me. It's got everything to do, I guess, with the movie. I guess the connection there, I mean, the way that Fedora does their little namings, it has to have some kind of connection with the previous name. The connection there is that Keanu Reeves portrayed Constantine, which was Fedora 12, as well as Klaatu in the remake of The World, The Day the Earth Stood Still. My name does not come from the new movie, it comes from the old movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, as well as Evil Dead, Army of Darkness, specifically the third one in the Evil Dead series. So that's where my name came from. It had nothing to do with Keanu Reeves. Keanu Reeves is apparently on a mission to ruin me. Ron also wrote me about an Asus Tech and NVIDIA dual project or something, and they created this 1.1 teraflop supercomputer out of 960 NVIDIA GPU cores. I don't know what a teraflop is. I don't really care all that much about supercomputers in terms of, like, you know, sitting down and actually researching it. So I don't know how fast that is or what that would be good for. I imagine it would be very fast and very good for a lot of things, but nothing near what I would be doing, I'm sure. I'm sure it would be wasted on me. But the interesting part about that story is, I think, that they're actually, you know, that people are finally using and being able to harness these graphic processing cores for real-world things other than just gaming, you know? I mean, nothing wrong with gaming. You know, some people love it, some people live by it. That's great. I admire those people. But in terms of having all that power just to render, you know, Boba Fett so that he looks more realistic, it's just not that big of a deal to me. But to actually harness that power and give me faster video rendering time or quicker response on, you know, 3D animation and stuff, I mean, that's almost similar, I guess, to gaming. But I don't know, that is more interesting to me. So it's really cool that they're doing that with the GPU stuff. There's apparently an Arch live CD out. It's a live CD, I guess, well, like I said, for Arch. It's supposed to have some kind of, you know, automatic hardware configuration like most live CDs would. And it's got KDE as the default desktop. And it is called the Chakra Project. So that's chakra-project.org. Check it out if you are into Arch and seeing what it can do and stuff like that. A live CD for Arch, I mean, that kind of seems almost like a live CD for Gen 2, right? You're just like, well, why would you want the live CD for that? But I would have said the same thing about ZenWalk or Slamp or something like that, you know, where you've got, they take Slackware, where, you know, part of the fun is kind of taking it and and configuring it the way you want, installing it so that you are installing what you actually want to install, stuff like that. But sometimes, you know, you start to get to know kind of the way a distro does something, and you start to really like that. You start to get really attached to that. And so having a live CD of it where you can actually skip all the installation stuff, because maybe all you really want is a good system that is running all the stuff that you're familiar with underneath it, but you don't necessarily want to sit there and configure it all for yourself. That's when something like Woolvix or Zenwalk or Slamp comes in really handy, because you get Slackware, but you also get it all done for you, and you don't have to be bothered by it. So it's kind of like having your cake and eating it too, right? So this presumably would be similar. So speaking of Slackware, actually, G-Slapped and SlappedGet have released like new versions of them, or some bug fixes or something. For SlappedGet, it's 0.10.2b. G-Slapped 0.5.2a. So I really don't follow either of the projects. I don't use SlappedGet and I don't use G-Slapped, and I can't really say why, except that I never really felt like I needed them, and I don't feel like I'm all that fond, and I don't want to make a commitment here to something, but I don't feel like I'm all that fond of these kind of, database-based application managers or package managers. I realize that they're really well designed, and I mean, I love apt-get and I love yum when I use them, but sometimes I don't want to use them, and I just want to install stuff either from source or from a package, and then you can just keep the package in your /var/log packages, and it's there, and you don't really have to think that much about it. You don't have to learn how to update the database or how to search through the history of the database. I mean, these are all cool things, and they're fun to learn, and I don't mind them. I just don't necessarily want them on my Slackware box, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So G-Slapped and SlappedGet I do not use, because I use Slackware in part to get away from those other systems, like the yum and the apt-get and stuff like that. Nothing wrong with them, just sometimes you don't want that, I think. And yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, you could just use Debian and Fedora without those systems, I guess, sort of, although not really, because I think they're kind of built with them anyway, so, you know, it's not like you're going to be able to get away from them. I mean, they're really pretty integrated into the system, I think. So, I don't know. Slackware is refreshing for that reason, for me, anyway. Other people see it as a huge liability, and I might see it as a huge liability. It kind of depends on the setting, you know. I mean, maybe I wouldn't want to do that all the time, but I do like the way that Slackware does the package management, because it's very understandable, it's very hands-on, and it's easy, I think. So I was invited to Google Wave, really not interested in it, really not interested in it. But yeah, it's just not going to happen, Ron, thank you, but no, I don't want to get on the Wave, I don't want to be a part of the Wave, I'm just not interested in it. So, I mean, I guess it doesn't really take a genius to see the cycle here, right? I mean, in my mind, it started with MySpace, but probably some people would even cite something earlier, maybe like Friendster or whatever that was. It starts with that thing, and everyone gets on it, and everyone uses it, and then it kind of fades out of favor, or it gets spammed to being unusable, and so everyone then shifts away, and then it became Facebook, and now it's Twitter. You can just see the wave coming. It's going to be the Google wave, and then it's going to be something else. So I'm just not interested in jumping on those things, and yes, I do have a Facebook account, but I only did it because Enigma from Hacker Public Radio said that I needed to have a Hacker Public Radio public face, had to be there for fellow HPR people, but I don't really use it that much, and certainly I'm not in love with it. So, and the opposite side of this coin is obviously that these are great ways to stay in touch with people that you want to stay in touch with. Obviously, I mean, MySpace, I got a lot of use out of that, and it reconnected me with some older friends who I hadn't seen in a long time, so it was really cool to be able to stay in touch with them. And there was something mentally different about going onto MySpace and saying hi, as opposed to, like, emailing them and sending them a little note. You know, it's interesting to see how email is kind of developing into almost a formal form of communication, and you almost have to go for, like, text messaging or maybe IMing or definitely some of these other like social networking sites in order to do the more casual thing. So it is an interesting web 2.0 sociological study, I guess, but point being that I don't want to get on the wave, so I'm not going to get on the wave. But if you want a wave invitation, I guess maybe Ron has one. Let's see, there's a cool little Python server that you can run. Like, it's Python. It's a Python web server. You can map it to, I guess, localhost:8000 or 880, whatever they use. Or no, it looks like they say 8000. They're saying 8000. I guess it's really up to you. And then you make a directory, specifically makedir-pv in your home, simple HTTP server /uploadable files. And you copy the files that you want in the uploadable files, and then I guess you start this little Python web server, and it's on. People can then go into your little website on your computer and grab files off of it. Obviously, this is dangerous, you know, opening up your computer to other people. You're just asking to be hacked eventually, but it is a cool option, and you could certainly do it on your internal network, and that would be very handy. Or you can do it on an external one, I guess. I just don't know anything about security, much less security with this little Python simple web server. But it really is a cool little hack or whatever. And I'll just have to paste the code into the show notes or something, because I don't really know where this came from exactly. But it was very interesting. Python is just always surprising me. There's that bias that one gets, I think, from hearing people say, oh, well, you can't use Python for stuff, it's too slow. And then every single time I hear about anything Python, it's incredible. You know, like Wicked and this little web server, and there's video editing stuff in Python. It's just, I don't know, I'm kind of like, it might be slow, but I mean, so are shell scripts, right? And so, I don't know, I'm kind of digging Python lately, again. Ron wrote me about a binary clock. You can actually create a binary clock in your terminal. It's kind of funny. I have no idea how to read these things, so it doesn't much matter, but it's from codeinthehole.com. Codeinthehole.com. It's one line. It's like watch-in1, quote, echo, O base equals 2, escape character, so what's that, a backslash, colon, escape character, I think that's a backslash again, single quote, date plus %s, escape character quote, and then you pipe that to BC, which is a calculator program for the terminal. And it just sits there and ticks the binary numbers away as time passes, and it's kind of funny, and it's interesting. I don't know, you just wonder who comes up with them and how they manage it. I've always liked it. It's neat to hear about and to see. Let's see, Tomas said that he really appreciated the Blender tutorials that I did, which I guess are somewhere on straightedgelinux.com. I think it's in Klaatu's how-tos link on the left side of that page. There's a video Blender. There's two or three different how-tos on Blender. Tomas wanted to know, because he took some footage with a camera suction cupped to the bottom of his car. So he's got all this great footage, and it's all, of course, upside down. And he was asking if there was anything that would flip that footage in Blender. I don't think have I read this email before? It's sounding really, really familiar. Well, we'll see. So what I told him was that my gut instinct would be not to do that in Blender at all, but I would do it outside of Blender. If all of your footage is flipped, and you know that you need all your footage to be turned around 180 degrees, then why bother having Blender do it if it's a big batch thing that's invariably needs to be flipped? Just do it in FFmpeg or Mincode or something like that. So you do that, and then you just re-import the new footage that you've flipped from Mincoder or FFmpeg into Blender, and now you don't need to flip it in Blender. You've already flipped it. That would be the smart way to do it. But maybe there are just a couple of shots that you need to flip, right? Well, again, I didn't know how to do it. I think he wrote me back and said that he figured it out. Let me look into what he said. He said that he added an effect strip which has a rotate and mirror as one of the properties. Huh, okay. He doesn't say which one. But there are plugins for Blender, many plugins. There are texture plugins and sequence plugins. And sequence plugins are the ones that you can use in your video sequence editor, obviously. So if you go to www.users.cs.umn.edu/-mein, M-E-I-N, /blender/plugins/sequence.html, there's a boatload of cool little plugins for Blender's video sequence editor that literally gives you controls over things that, I mean, you don't expect to see in something that is quote-unquote not a video editor, you know? I mean, it's amazing what Blender's got open to it. It give me Blender with these plugins, and really, I've almost got everything that I have in something like Final Cut or Avid just from those plugins. They're just so many plugins. So if you're into Blender and you're looking for plugins, hit that site up. It's definitely worth checking out. They're easy to install as well. And of course, on Slacker Media, there are tutorials or whatever on how to do that. But essentially, if they need compiling, you compile them. A lot of them just come as pre-compiled shared object files or something like that. And all you have to do is just keep it in some folder somewhere on your system. And then in Blender user preferences, you simply define that location as a plugin folder, and now you've got all your plugins available to you in Blender. Last but certainly not least, Victor wrote me and said that he really enjoyed the Slackware episodes that I did, the two or three episodes that I did. Thank you, Victor. And he says that he was curious to know how to limit a guest account on a Linux machine. And I wrote him back and told him that actually I'm not really sure how to do that, aside from doing it in Slackware. I can do it in Slackware because Slackware kind of does it for me. That's just the way they implement creation of the user. The little shell script that they provide, the add user shell script, steps through the process of creating a user, and the defaults are pretty limited. The user does get placed into a general users group, so that's one thing that I actually scale back. You know, I create a group just for that one user so that they're not a member of any other group. They are the other. And they're not, you know, if I don't add them to CD-ROM access and audio access and video access and all that other stuff, they're fairly limited in the kind of thing that they can do with the computer, which is the idea. Now, on distributions that are created as desktop distributions, like Fedora or Ubuntu or Mandriva or, you know, PC Linux OS or Mepis, all those, they make it so that when you create a user, they are added to the typical default groups that a full-featured user on a normal desktop system would kind of expect to have that functionality. So I don't know how to work around that because I don't know enough about the way that the whole user thing is implemented. You could try the actual, rather than add user, which is a Slackware script, you can try user add, which is what add user calls, I believe. And there might be some, you know, rather than even doing a GUI front end as well, like on Fedora, you've got the GUI front end for the user and group management, same way for Ubuntu, and you know, all those have like some kind of GUI application of adding users, managing groups, things like that. So you could try to use the actual user add command, the Unix command, and see if you can't limit the guest user that way. Generally what I do on a Fedora box or whatever, it's generally a Fedora box because that's primarily what else I run, but I would just do little completely insecure, you know, just security through obscurity kind of hacks to the desktop to limit the user, because I would be going under the assumption that we're not trying to protect this computer, this guest account, from leet hacksaws coming over for tea with the secret intention of cracking into your computer. That's giving them physical access is it's all over, right? So, I mean, you'd be lost. So we're assuming that the person you're lending your computer to across the cafe table is sitting right there. They're your friend. They have no intention of screwing your system up. You're just letting them borrow your internet. The browser right now. And even this, admittedly, is becoming less and less frequent for me, at least, because all my friends simply pull out whatever brand of phone with their data plans and just check their email that way. So it's not even that much of an issue. But sometimes they'll want to jump on a computer and go to, you know, IMDb or Wikipedia or something like that, and or Facebook, that's a big one. And that's fine. And I'm sitting right there, and they're not going to be plugging in any suspicious-looking thumb drives or CD-ROMs or DVDs or anything like that without my intervention. So I just do silly things like, you know, remove the device notifier in the guest account. You know, when I log in as the guest and I kind of set up KDE so that there's no device notifier. So if they do plug in a device or a CD or something, it doesn't come up. Like I say, if they're familiar with Linux, they're gonna know exactly what to do. Or if they're familiar with, well, yeah, either Linux or KDE, they're gonna work around that. But I'm assuming that that's not who's using the computer on this guest account, because it never is. It's always a dumb Windows or OS 10 user. I'll remove the K menu as well. I will log out with what is it, Alt F2. I have that mapped to something else on my keyboard, but in the guest account, it defaults to the standard one, which is Alt F2. So I just hit Alt F2 and then type in log out, and it logs out. You know, unless they are familiar with the default tradition of Alt F2 equal run a command on a Linux box, or maybe on Windows 2, I really don't know, but they're not familiar with that, and I don't think many people are, then they're not gonna know, there doesn't seem to be an applications menu, I'll just hit Alt F2 and see if I can get a run command interface. If I really wanted to protect from that, I could probably limit their access to all the different applications that I didn't want them to have access to, but that's just too much work for the purpose of what I'm doing. Now, if you're setting up like a kiosk at work and it's supposed to be like an internet kiosk in the lunch break room, and people are coming in and they're checking their email and they're browsing the internet on their break, and you don't want them to be able to do something, and you don't want, if they had a bad day, you don't want them to be able to come in and just maliciously delete some important files, then yeah, you should probably do a little bit research on how you can limit a user's access to various parts of the Linux system. It wouldn't be that hard, you know. I mean, you could definitely do it. I've never tried to actually be that hardcore about it and actually create, like, a kiosk. Although I think Ian Geller at Southeast Linux Fest, I was talking to him, I think it was him, and he was talking about KDE developing, they were kind of developing some kind of kiosk mode, so that sounds kind of interesting. That could be something to look into. But, the guest account, I don't do that hardcore. It's really just simple little cheap things that I can hack together to make kind of a more or less somewhat kind of isolated environment. And then that's all they get. You know, that's their environment. Probably, I guess I'm thinking aloud at this point. I guess what you could do, I'm sure someone might email me with some ideas as well. I mean, not that I need them, but if you have ideas, you can certainly feel free to email. But like, I'm thinking you could get rid of the path, basically. You could just have their path be basically nothing, and then download a local copy or compile a local copy, you know, as a self-contained copy of Firefox, and install that into the guest home bin directory and make that be their path. And then you could just give them access to that one application, because that's probably all they're going to need, realistically, right? Firefox, maybe dump a copy of KWrite or OpenOffice in. Well, not OpenOffice, that's too feature-filled for just a guest. Firefox is actually a little bit large for a guest, I think, but, I mean, come on, you're not going to be able to avoid that. But certainly something like maybe a picture viewer or something. But see, then it's already getting too complex, because then you're like, you're designing this whole system for a guest user that's going to appear, like, once every month, if that, you know. So yeah, I guess the cheap hacks seem to be working for me, and I don't, they're it's always my friends using the computer. They have no malicious intent. I'm just protecting them. I'm just kind of removing all sharp objects out of their way, basically, you know. It's just so they don't hurt themselves or the computer completely by accident. That's what I do. So far it's worked for me on Fedora. On Slackware I can get a little bit more hardcore. But again, it's not because I'm doing anything special. It's because that's how Slackware was designed, so I just benefit from that. But thanks for writing, Victor, and thanks for saying that you liked the Slackware episodes. And my friend Gregor wrote me, and he used to do the Linux Void podcast. And as far as I know, that's not a podcast that is occurring anymore. I think it's sort of over, simply because, you know, I mean, anytime you bring in more than one person, pretty much. The scheduling conflicts and things like that just make podcasting really, really difficult. I know this from experience, so I understand why they aren't, you know, releasing more podcasts. But it is a pity that they're not, because that was a really good show. I really enjoyed it. But anyway, he emailed me, and he was talking about something called Pure Darwin. Now, Pure Darwin is a project that, as you can imagine, is taking the Darwin kernel, slapping some GNU and BSD utilities on top of it, and, you know, kind of making a Unix distribution based on the Darwin kernel, obviously. So this was an interesting project to me, because I knew that they'd been trying to do this earlier with something called either GNU Darwin or Open Darwin, or possibly both, or possibly both of those terms referred to the same project. I don't really remember. But that project died some kind of death, and I'm not sure exactly what kind of death it was. Certainly my impression from just kind of researching a little bit online back when I saw that it existed, I saw some posts, you know, something about Apple just not being forthcoming enough with any kind of real helpful information or useful information. And this is interesting because even in Pure Darwin, if you go to puredarwin.org, you will see that they have a code page over at google.com, google.com, I think, code.google.com, whatever. And in the forums, one of the bugs, I think the outstanding bug in it is the Darwin source code is not easily accessible. And this is kind of what I've been saying for a while, and that is that Apple is, you know, they might not be, you know, they're saying that they're I don't even know if they claim to be an open source friendly company, to be honest. They simply say that they're based on Unix, so they're not saying anything about open source or free software or anything that I can really detect. But they certainly, I mean, they have an opensource.apple.com or something like that. They have a developer connection, all these other things, and they, if you dig around deep enough, they do kind of, they talk a good game a little bit, but they don't ever really trumpet the ideals of free software, to be sure. Even though, of course, they are based on stacks and stacks of free software, so, or open source software, I guess, if we want to split hairs. So my point that I'm trying to get to is that Apple doesn't seem to be motivated in any way to push these kinds of projects forward at all. Meaning that if you take a look at the fact that, you know, they do have a developer, they do have the Darwin kernel sources, you know, the parts that are open source, right, and that are covered under the Apple public license or something like that. They do, the GNU project says this is not a GPL compatible license. Now, whether that's okay with you or not, you know, it depends. The point is that the source code of Darwin is, yes, it is online. You can't say that it's not available, although you could say probably that parts of it aren't available. I don't really know if certain things that I know are not open source are actually considered part of the kernel. So, but from what this bug was saying online, it seems like, yeah, not all parts of it are available. But the parts that they have said, yes, this is open source, you know, those are available online. Now, you have to register for a developer account at Apple, which kind of bugs me a little bit. I think that's not as friendly as it could be. I mean, if you think about, okay, let's go through it. So you go to the appledeveloper.com. You register for an account as a developer. Maybe you use a fake name, fake email, you know, whatever, but you do it. You get access. And then you go to, you know, you look through the links and until you finally find the source code for the kernel. I mean, it doesn't take forever. I shouldn't say finally, but it's not right there. You find the source code, and then you're confronted with, like, I don't know, 30 or 45 little files to download. There is no easy way to simply say, yes, that's the kernel, let me download it all. Now, why they wouldn't have that, I don't know. And maybe you could do it with a good, an interesting wget command. I don't really know. I've never tried it. I've not been that dedicated to the idea. But I'm just saying for someone who wants to go there and download the source code and start compiling, it's not quite as easy. Now, compare that to the kernel.org method of things. You go to kernel.org, front page, top right-hand corner, the latest source is here, it's a link, you click on it, you download the source, and you start compiling. It's definitely different. The kernel.org, they want you to have the source code, you know, you get that feeling. It's sort of a perceived welcome mat. I mean, here's the source code, download it, it's right here on our front page. No, you don't have to register, no, we don't ever have to know who you are, or why you came, or why you're downloading this source code. The Apple version of this is a lot different. There's registration involved, you're joining their little crew of developers, they've got your information so that they can spam you and offer you to go to the developer workshops and the special developer events that cost $2,000, and you get the developer kits that cost money. You know, it's like a lot different. And then you get the source code files for the kernel, and it's not just a nicely tar.gz or BZ2 archive, it's a bunch of them. It's like 45 of them that you'd have to download each individually. So that's just a little bit different. There's a little bit of a difference there, I think. And it's not the same. And in terms of just downloading all those files and then just unzipping them all and then compiling them all, I'm not quite sure how fast or easy that would be. And I don't even know if you can do it and just get a working kernel without a lot of intervention from the user or basically a programmer. And I think that's what a project like Pure Darwin and Open Darwin or GNU Darwin before that would probably have been trying, like, to get this Darwin kernel that Apple gives them into a working order. And from the bug report on Pure Darwin, it appears that it is indeed not just as easy as going there, registering, downloading all 45 files or 30 or 25, whatever it is, 15, who knows, give them the benefit of a doubt, all those files and then unzipping them all and then compiling them in some manner. From what I can tell, it's not as easy as that. And I can certainly imagine that it's not. It doesn't seem like it would be to me. So, point is that I don't get the overwhelming feeling that Apple is all about encouraging these kinds of independent little branches of their products. And I'm not really quite sure why a company would open source something unless they were simply legally bound, or they just really, really feel that it's a marketing advantage to say, yes, this is open source, so that if anyone says, how dare you use, all this open source software and give nothing back, they can always point to this page of kernel sources and say, what do you mean we never gave anything back? Look at our kernel page. And I've heard horror stories about this before, too, and I mean, the very reason that you've got WebKit and you still have KHTML is, and I don't have links to actually cite my references, so take all this with a grain of salt, but you can do searches for this kind of thing, and you will find hits. But, a lot of the people working on KHTML simply don't want to, and I read a blog post about this, actually. They simply don't want to work for Apple. They don't want to be working for free for a company that's going to take all their code and kind of like almost engineer the way that it kind of take over the direction of the project. I mean, if Apple is the big entity saying, okay, I'm going to use this technology, then KHTML is, if you join up with WebKit, you're not doing KHTML anymore, you're doing WebKit, and you're kind of working toward Apple's goal. So that's why there is a WebKit and a KHTML still. And I heard as well at the KDE release event at Google from a couple of developers, that the reason KHTML and WebKit were a little bit far apart for a while was because when Apple did give the code back to KHTML people, they just dropped it on them. They just gave them a big pile of code and just said, there it is. There's all the code. So, you hear about companies doing this kind of thing where, yes, they follow the letter of the law, but that's about it. So they're just giving you what they had to give you, but they're not doing it nicely. They're not being a good sport about it. So I get that sense about Apple and Pure Darwin and Open Darwin and GNU Darwin. I get the sense that while, yes, they did do what they had to do or they're doing what is wise for them to do marketing, what they deem a wise marketing move, and I guess you can't really argue that they don't know marketing, they're not really doing anything in the spirit of what we're all talking about when we say open source, or more specifically, and that's probably why this term exists, but free software, this kind of sharing of development and of technology and of progress. Compare this, of course, to something like, to some company, Red Hat, trucking along, selling services and stuff like that. They're doing fine. For whatever reason, they continue to sponsor in a big way the Fedora project. They got paid people on their staff working on the Fedora project. I don't know if it's full-time, I don't know if it's part-time. Point is, part of their day that they're paid for gets spent working on Fedora. They don't have to do that. They really don't have to do that. I'm not saying it's a huge gift. I'm not going to, bow down to Red Hat because they're doing it. I'm just saying they don't have to. But they do, which is kind of nifty. Novell, they've got Sled or whatever they've got, and yet they continue with the whole OpenSUSE thing. Now, I don't know. I don't really use SUSE, so I don't really have any impression of, the relationship between the community and Novell, but I perceive that it's pretty good. I mean, I've seen Zonker, Joe Zonker Brockmeyer speak at a couple of festivals now, and I mean, he seems to be kind of, the whole community manager type. You don't see a community manager at Apple, from Apple, I mean, you don't see that. There's no such idea. You don't see any kind of back and forth between Apple and its open source crew of developers. You don't ever hear about, well, again, KHTML people going back and forth collaboratively with Apple and wow, what a great company they are, and sharing all their improvements and stuff like that. It you just don't get that for whatever reason. And I think that if it was there and Apple wanted to market it and pimp it, they could do that, and they would do that because it would behoove them to do so. But I don't think it's there because I don't think they're really interested in that. I really don't. So my point is, I don't believe Apple is into the whole open source thing. I don't think they're into a whole, oh, please make a distro based on our kernel thing. Whether, you know, that's just not in their marketing plan. They don't understand that kind of marketing. They understand something else. I don't know what they understand, but that's what they understand. Definitely not like, let's get people interested in this kernel, and then maybe they'll get interested in the OS, or, you know, whatever you might imagine would come from a Darwin-based open source project. I don't know. Or maybe they don't see that happening. Maybe they just figured that would be a dead end, that people interested in kernels aren't the same people interested in the shiny new Mac brand computer with the shiny new OS, you know, and that's probably a valid concern. I mean, I don't think there is much of a kernel community around the Darwin, you know, kernel. I mean, you've got people into the BSD kernel, I guess. You got people into the Linux kernel. You got people into the Solaris kernel. I mean, I don't know how many people actually contribute. I mean, BSD, as far as I understand, is only contributed to a set group of people. I don't know anything about the Solaris kernel, so I don't know. But I mean, you've got people definitely into the Linux kernel. You know, I mean, there's a large community of people interested in the Linux kernel and its progress and how it works and all that other good stuff. I don't see that kind of sort of group of, you know, ooh, let's talk about the Darwin kernel now, or the Mach kernel. So I think that if any group wants to, I don't know why any group would want to create a Unix distribution based on the Darwin kernel. I really don't. But I think that Apple doesn't want you to do it, so I don't think that these projects really get very far, which is a pity because I think kernels are really interesting. I don't understand them. I'd like to know more about them. I'd like to kind of take a couple for a test run, stuff like that, but it's not going to happen. Now, in terms of the Darwin kernel, or rather Pure Darwin itself, not only is the project kind of, I don't know, I don't get the sense that it's terribly active. If you go there, I think their last release was on Valentine's or last Christmas or something like that. It was a while ago. And in addition to that, you don't go there and just find download our ISO. You can't find it. Now, in the same way on the Open or the GNU Darwin project, it was really hard to find a downloadable ISO. I think they were selling them for a while or something, but it was really hard to find the link. I mean, you could probably dig around and possibly find it, but on the Pure Darwin one, I don't think they have one. You have to download like their virtual image of their distribution, and then from the virtual image, create an ISO or burn an ISO or something, which, I mean, that's backwards. Why force me to do it that way? If you want me to come and try your distro, give me an ISO. Let me try it. So, I don't know. Not impressed, I guess, with the implementation. Not unimpressed with the idea, although, I don't think I would probably switch over to a Darwin-based OS, just like I'm probably not going to switch anytime soon to a Solaris-based OS or a BSD-based OS. Even so, I would love to do a benchmark. I'd love to compare BSD, Solaris, and Darwin, and Linux, put them all on the same hardware, take them for a spin, you know, do multimedia projects on them, see what they're like, see how they each one of them performs. But, I mean, Darwin's not in the running because they don't have an ISO for me, Open Darwin, Pure Darwin, whatever it is. So that's, I guess that's the state of that project. Not to say anything disparaging about the people behind that project. Like I say, I think it's a really interesting idea, and I'll bet that they were really into it for a while, and I'll bet it was going along great, and then they just finally were realizing that they weren't getting any kind of support from the company producing the kernel, and it probably started to die down after that. That's my guess. Maybe they just got busy with life. I know how hard it is to keep a project of any type going, so I wouldn't be surprised if that was it either. But yeah, it looks like a Darwin distro, not quite yet, but thanks for the link, Gregor. It was a really interesting look, and yeah, kernels are cool, I guess. There's a really good book by O'Reilly called Understanding the Linux Kernel, which I was reading, haven't finished yet, and I had to take it back to the library. It's a really in-depth book, probably way over my head, but I got through a couple of chapters, and it was interesting. So if you ever see that one, you might want to take a look at it. It's a good read. I think that's about all the listener feedback I can find at the moment. Thanks to everyone for listening, and let's wrap this up. My contact information, clat2@hackerpublicradio.org or clat2@linuxcranks.info. Website is thebadapples.info. You can also check out straightedgelinux.com/slackermedia. That's my Slacker Media quote-unquote distro from text, meaning that it's just a bunch of tutorials that helps you design your Slackware better for multimedia use. You can also find me on IRC typically, or rather, not so much right now because I've been really busy, but if I'm in IRC, you can find me typically in Linux Cranks, that is pound Linux Cranks or hash Linux Cranks, whatever. My name on there is notclat2. That is also my username on Jabber, so notclat2@jabber.org. You can find me if you want to IM. And I think that probably covers it. So, yeah, thanks for listening, and I will catch you next time.
Psycho host me.